Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.
One of the reasons why I wanted to write a book on racism, actually, and positive black racial identity was because in my family, I have children, in particular nieces and nephews, who are, I have black nieces and nephews, but I also have nieces and nephews that would be classified as being mixed heritage. And what I discovered when I was, working and supporting these children was some of the conversations that I overheard the younger ones in my family having about color. And I began to be very disturbed when one of my beautiful, beautiful, I mean, if you see her, beautiful nieces at age 4, came home and told me that she didn't like her blackness. She didn't like her skin color. And in fact, she was wondering why it is she didn't have a whiter skin color. Now, I'm out there as a community activist, and I'm there on the platforms internationally and nationally and up and down the country talking about these issues and trying to organize and work. And within my own family, I discovered this. And I said, no, this cannot work. I have to start doing the repairs, the self-repairs in my own family. And so it was that experience, very personal experience, that was also very painful for me. Because as much as, you know, we're trying to do the work, the reality existing is deep.
Pam?
Yes, I'm here.
I just wanted to share something with you. As you know, I purchased your book recently, The Beauty Con Game.
Thank you.
And I shared this story on Facebook, and it just made me laugh. You know, I'm reading the book, and my daughter that lives with her mother comes over on the weekends. And so she came over this weekend, and I gave her the book. She said, Why did you give this book to me? Is it because I was wearing those blue contacts that time? And I said, no, but now that you mention it, yeah, here's the book. And I just thought that was really cute and timely. And I do appreciate you writing that book.
Wow. So it didn't turn into a knockdown, drag-out battle?
No, she just asked the question. I just handed her the book. I had my own reasons, but I hadn't, you know, I did not know how to talk to her about, you know, because I noticed the blue contacts because her mother would wear them sometimes. So I know where she was getting it from, you know, the long straight hair weave and all of that stuff. And I just started noticing that she was coming into her own as a teenager, as a person, that she was suffering from that mental illness of not wanting to be black or thinking black is not beautiful. Okay. And I know that comes from her mother, because her mother was verbally abused. She was the darkest of the child, of the grandchildren, and the grandmother used to call her, you so black, you so ugly. I'm serious. And so I knew her mother was suffering from what her mother had told me. And so I know that's where she started picking up wearing blue contacts and wearing this and wearing that. And so when I handed her the book, I didn't know how to talk to her about it. I tried to get my older daughters to talk to her, and, you know, they did. But when I handed her the book, she said, "Is this because I had those blue contacts on that time?" And I said, "No, because I wasn't even thinking about it." And I said, "No, but now that you mention it." So she's reading the book. I told her she can't take it home because I needed to do the interview with you. But as soon as I'm through with it, you know, she can take it home.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, May 24th, 2017, so I have been told. We will be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Workplace Racism. Every Thursday, Workplace Racism. If you have suggestions, problems on the job, you figured out how to avoid difficulties, get your promotions, get your raise, get the biggest office in the building, and chill until you are ready to retire. If you figured out how to do that as a black person, you should be the first person to dial in tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and have a manual, or at least, you know, a bullet point list with 10 or 15 things that we can do to come up in a similar manner. Friday, Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. We are almost done. I think two sessions and we're done. Second to last, we will wrap it up. Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And Saturday, the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Stay tuned. Broadcast for today. We had a few reschedules, but we're able to remain patient. And I had already told our guest if we had any further shenanigans, we were going to have a posse heading to Chicago, and Spike Lee was going to have to do Chi-Raq Volume 2, because it was going to be some name calling going down in the Windy City. But we are thankful we are able to have easily one of our favorite guests. I know for years and years and years, that audio segment that you heard at the beginning of the broadcast, that was from 5 years ago. Founder of Black Talk Radio Network, Mr. Scotty Reed, talking about outstanding information in the book, The Beauty Con Game. Our guest, author, co-author of a litany of great counter-racist reading material. A lot of it we've covered right here on the program. The Interracial Con Game, which I think we'll reference today. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, more to come. You can also check out the blog racismws.com, linked in the description, racismws.com. I even linked with the video, a black female just did an audio review of Black Love as a Revolutionary Act. She had so many wonderful things to say about the book and comments about how it helped her understanding of racism. It's linked in the description at Black Talk Radio Network. Always one of our favorites. I know folks are so happy to hear from her. They were so disgruntled, and the tears of emojis when we had to reschedule the last couple of weeks. I didn't think some people were going to make it, but we held on, got her back with us once again. Trojan Horse Publications, Pam. Are you with us, Pam?
Oh, yes, I am.
Outstanding. Almost had you all again. So glad you could make it back with us. Just really, really happy to have you back on the broadcast. It has been way too long. I think the last time you were with us was The night after the election, November 2016, I think everyone, well, Cal's listeners were probably gloating. I know I was. The folks who had said, we told you this was going to happen. But the rest of the folks were still kind of stunned, trying to figure out what took place. Just before we kind of dig in, for anyone, you know, we got new listeners. This might be their first time hearing from you. Anything that you want to tell them about who you are, the work you do, Trojan Horse Publications?
Well, just very briefly, I would say I'm a person that's working my way through confusion, work in progress. I backslide. I try to take a step forward. It's very difficult when you live in an urban area like Chicago, the Chicago area. It's very difficult to maintain a certain perspective. I wrote the books. I don't know what drove me to write the books, but it was just something that I had to do. And I do feel I didn't write them by myself. I mean that in the spiritual sense. You know, there were things that went into the book, and I had no idea where they came from. You know, sometimes I would look at the book, and I would be like, wow, you know, where did that thought come from? You know, where did that? I have some moments of clarity, extreme clarity. And I was kind of amazed by the clarity that I had in that regard, because I'm lacking it in other things, right? So I just feel it was something that was supposed to happen. I feel like I was supposed to write these books, and so there they are, you know. They've helped me quite a bit, you know. I was writing them not just for the reader, but for myself. I was hoping that they would help other people. But that's all I would say about myself is that I'm struggling, just like everyone else out here, trying to maintain a clear head, trying not to become anti-black, because it's very easy where I live to do that, because there are a lot of traumatized, psychologically disturbed people that I worked with, that I'm around, and sometimes I get disgusted, and it's not just necessarily a black thing, it's just a people thing. I try to maintain some humanity, because it's difficult to deal with people in an urban area where people are really nerve-wracked. But all I can say is just do the best you can. And the one piece of advice I give anybody is try to maintain some humility if you can, and try to maintain some humanity. And try to keep in mind that when you find yourself being really judgmental, which I often do, ask yourself, would you want someone to judge you with the same yardstick? And so you have to constantly just pull your reins back. And I hope the book can help give people some clarity as to how to do that.
Amen. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation. The Interracial Con Game. And the Beauty Con Game. We've discussed all of the text on the program previously. You can go back in the archives and hear in-depth discussion about all of the writing. And you can go online, Amazon, visit the website, racismws.com, and you will see links where you can get ebooks, hard copies of the text, great literature, great reading material. You can share with others if they're trying to bolster their counter-racist library with constructive information. I guess getting right to one of the questions, a listener, they wrote me, I think a week or so ago. I don't even think they knew you were about to be back on the program, but they said, I'm currently reading The Interracial Con Game, and there are multiple quotations from a piece called Der Kosmonaut, 1972. Is this a book or a movie? If so, where can I find a copy? These quotes are fascinating. Can you, just for our listeners, give them a little snippet of why you included Der Kosmonaut 1972, what that piece is talking about, and then answer the listener's question?
Well, I'm trying to remember where I found it. I found it online. It wasn't in a book, to my knowledge. It was an essay or an article. And it might have even been Josh Wickett. For some reason, he pops into my head. I'm not sure if I got it from him, but I found it online. And as I was reading it, I wasn't sure that, you know, because there's so much written, like Willie Lynch letter, that allegedly doesn't really exist. but it still encapsulates the principle of what happened to black people, you know, when we were broken psychologically during slavery. So I wasn't sure if that piece was legitimately written by the person that proposed to write it, but I felt it was significant in that it personified the mindset of a racist white female regarding her sexual activity with black men. And I could see examples throughout the whole society, not just in America, but all over, of how black males were being destroyed psychologically and being manipulated, extremely manipulated, by a white woman's vagina. And that the connection between sex and racism, to me, was evident in that piece. The connection between power and sex for the white female was evident in that piece. So I included it because I felt like even if it wasn't legitimately written by the author that it was alleged to be written by, I felt it made some valuable points. And I just thought it was food for thought. Because it may actually be authentic. It may actually be written by someone. But I just felt that it was brutal enough to make you sit back and say, what? Could this be what's happening in regards to sex between a black male and a racist white female? Could this actually be her mindset? And I see there's a lot of evidence that supports that. I'm not saying every white female has the same mentality. You know, I'm not going to say that. But what I'm saying is there's a lot of evidence when you look at a lot of black males and the stories that they've told me, in particular one black male that I put in the book, The Interracial Con Game, who sent me a ton of emails. He still emails me to this day about his experiences in Europe and how confused he was and how much sexual activity he had and how he was abused and degraded and humiliated and how he watched countless black men in Europe being humiliated and degraded by white females who used sex to lure them in. And I just, you know, I just felt like it was perfect to me. It actually fit a description. I mean, to me, it was just so brutal. It was just so in your face that I felt, you know, it might be, you know, it couldn't help but be food for thought. But I can't possibly say it came out of a book. I really have no idea where it came from.
I see. For listeners, if you have not read The Interracial Con Game, the passage being referenced, and I had to relocate, so I don't have my library at easy hand, so I could snatch this off the shelf. But since this is a book I read, I think my memory is good enough. This portion, Dear Cosmonaut, 1972, I think this is a white woman. And one of the profound things that she says in this commentary, I believe, is for black females or non-white females who are concerned that, you know, we white women are taking your husband, it's not about that at all. This is just, you know, a little sexual arrangement. I can enjoy myself and then send, you know, Jamal back to the ghetto. Am I remembering correctly? Was that kind of the spirit of it?
Well, you know what? That was by a white female, actually, and she can be located online. That was a white female who, that wasn't her. She was... Mm-hmm. A white female, and you should, oh my God, I wish I could have put a picture in the book. Not to be, but, oh my goodness gracious, have mercy. You know, but she was a woman that said, you know, black women are worried about us taking their men, she says, but it's just about the sex, they're not the marrying kind anyway. Now, I'm trying to think of what her name was, but she was actual white female who was actually online, and let me see if I can, I do have some of the, I have some of the pages. I have the book right now from the white female supremacist, Dear Cosmonaut. So I do have those, some of those pages. I'm just trying to find the one that you're speaking of where she, she actually had it. If somebody sends me an email, I'm pretty sure I can still find that article because I bet it's still online. She had no shame. She had no shame, so they're not the marrying kind anyway.
Wow.
There it is.
Interracial
kind. She wants to really get down with sex. She, you know, she comes find a black man.
Wow. All of the behaviors, even when it looks like they're being friendly, they're practicing racism, white supremacy, waging war against black people. Got that out of the way. I told them I was going to make sure I got their question. Some of the other things that I wanted to touch on and try and maximize time and then make sure listeners, if you all have any questions, it's been so long since we've had Pam with us, if we've got folks who've been reading any of her books and you have a question about something that's in the book, now is the time. Take advantage. Dial in. You can ask your question or any, you know, other topics that have come up. It's been so long. If you just want to hear her perspective, go ahead. Dial in. I'm trying to make sure we get as many callers as possible. But a few other things that I wanted to touch on before we get some of the callers. I already stated, I guess, when we spoke with you last, it's the day after Donald Trump won the election. So it's been 6 months. We were kind of speculating. I know, right? We were speculating about, you know, how this would impact black people and what's it going to be like. What is our focus going to be? Is this going to have us in a state where we're more confused about what's going on? Is this going to, you know, get black people to a point where we're more focused and taking things more seriously? What's been your observation over the past 6 months?
Well, my observation has been lots of people who are listening to mainstream media, which I keep advising people, mainstream media is a huge source of distortion and misinformation. So basically, the most reactions I get are things straight out of CNN, straight out of NBC, straight out of CBS, or whatever local paper the person reads. I don't really hear anything that has any analysis to it. You know, I think the majority of people that I know, if they did vote, they voted for Clinton. And so basically, I just see the same level of confusion, people panicking. I tell people, don't panic. You know, it wasn't that great the last 8 years, and it's not, you know, I mean, it's, you know, my own personal opinion is you got to worry about the people running the system, not the individual who sits in the White House. Worry about the people running the system, who are always there, who have been there, who will still be continue to be there. But I haven't seen anything that makes me, well, actually, I do feel in the air that there's a lot of things going on with black people. You know, the police violence, the economic hardships that seem to be increasing. Like I did a post on my blog several weeks ago about the war on black male-female relationships is how you look at the television. I mean, you can't help but see it. If you watch television, when you see the commercials, there's no hardly any black people in the commercials. They're all people, black people with white parents, you know, I mean, with a black and white parent. The vast majority of people in the commercials now, with the exception of the black male who knows nothing but white people, black dark-skinned black women are invisible, pretty much. Black babies, dark-skinned black babies are invisible. If they have a child or a baby, the child is always has a white parent and a black parent. So they have these racially ambiguous black people who've now become the new, better, improved, the more improved black person. And so when I wrote that, I felt like I do feel that there may be a small increase of people who are actually starting to pay attention to what they're saying. And I don't know that Donald Trump has made a difference other than to make people feel that they're the danger is more, but I don't particularly think the danger is more. I think the danger has always been there, and I think the danger would have been there regardless of who got in. So that's the only thing that I have seen as far as just a feeling from some of the people that post on my blog. But the people I know personally, they haven't really changed. They haven't become more aware. Not from my experience.
Interesting. So is it the behavior that you've been observing over the last 6 months? No noticeable changes from the way things were when President Obama, we had our first black president and everybody hated his guts because he wasn't hooking up black people. Any noticeable change?
Not that I can see. The only thing I see is that Trump's in the hot seat versus Obama in the hot seat. I was glad to see Obama get out the hot seat. But it seems like they keep pulling him back in. And I kind of wonder, are they going to not let this black person go? You know, because Bush rode off into the sunset. He was done. It's like it seems like they keep pulling Obama back in, maybe with less frequency. So I'll be honest with you. It's a little confusing for me what the agenda is as far as politically, because I never thought Trump was going to come in and run anything, because the people that run it, they didn't go away. They're still there. They were there with Clinton. They were there with Bush Jr., Bush Sr. They were there with Obama. They haven't gone anywhere. So I just try to tell people when they start talking kind of hysterically is that your problem didn't start in 2017. Your problem was there before 2017. And your problem will be there after 2017. So I wouldn't focus on any one president, on your one face in the White House. I just wouldn't do it. So I don't have a lot of political discussions anymore because I just can't. I can't buy into this thing like, oh, we in trouble now. As far as I know, we've been in trouble. So, no, I haven't really noticed any increase in the heightened political awareness among the people that I'm around. You know, maybe people that I'm not around, but not the people I'm around. No, absolutely not. Whatever they believed in 2016, they believe in 2017.
Hmm. Context of white supremacy. One of the things you mentioned about your post from just a few weeks back about the consistent effort to maintain conflict between black males and black females, mm-hmm. I posted today, and this just came on the news literally like minutes or a few hours before we went live. So they have a screenshot from a new television show called Unicorn Land. And so they have an image of exactly what you just mentioned, highly melanated black female. And she has locks. So dark complexion, black female with locks, attractive too. And this is from this TV show Unicorn Land. And so the article, it's polyamorous polysaturation. Unconventional relationships abound on television. All that means is having some sort of sexual arrangement with many, many folks. So instead of one male and one female, it could be, you know, three guys and five females, and they're all, you know, together. This is our dating arrangement. We all just sleep around with each other. Today it could be Pam and Sue. Tomorrow it could be Pam and Jack. Who knows? So a little bit from the article, it says, let's look at some of the busiest shows on television in the past year or so, shall we? We do House of Cards, Girls, I Love Dick, Orphan Black, Transparent, and The Magicians Have in Common. Every one of them has featured unconventional romantic or sexual relationships involving more than two people. And then they go on to give like the details with some of these shows and the pairings and all of this. And as I stated, they have a dark complexion black female right in the feature for one of these. And it seems like black people kind of figure in a lot of these wacky sexual pairings that are all over television now. How does this fit into maintaining that conflict between black males and black females?
Well, one thing I have seen, just personally, I'm not speaking for the whole country, is I've seen a heightened level of sexual confusion among black people. And certainly sexual confusion creates conflict because I know of women who I don't truly believe are homosexual. But because the media pushes it, and because of the dissatisfaction with whatever their experiences have been with the opposite sex, they're now experimenting and trying things, which I don't think they would have done with the numbers of people I see doing it, had the media not pushed it. See, a lot of people, they're looking for somebody to tell them who to be and what to do and how to do it. And so I do feel that the conflict increases with the level of confusion. If you're with a man and you don't know if you want to be with, and you're messing around with women behind his back, how can that not create conflict and confusion? So I see a lot of that, you know, people experimenting with homosexuality. And I think that you just have to wonder, how can this lead to constructive, intelligent relationships? You know, I think the tendency to push promiscuity and lots of sex, swinging, or whatever you want to call it, the media pushes that. I know of people who have tried that. And I'm just saying that I don't see it being a benefit. I just think that it's a way of self-demoralizing yourself. So I see a lot of demoralization going on. I see a lot of bitterness. I see a lot of anger. And most of it, a lot of it comes from our confusion about what sex is supposed to be, about respecting our bodies, about respecting other people's bodies, And I think that the media has played a huge role in getting people to think anything goes. And if you're not doing everything and anything, you're not with it. You're not cool. You're not going to be popular. If people talk about peer pressure with children, I think peer pressure is worse with adults. You know, from what I have seen, I've seen grown people who feel left out if they're not doing what other grown people are doing. So I think the media has a huge role in pushing what I consider immoral and anti-spiritual and spiritual destructive, you know, types of sexual interactions. And certainly you can't have stable families or stable relationships when you're out there doing all this crazy stuff. So, yeah, the conflict is really horrendous. And then when you look at the imagery, if you see a black woman in a romantic relationship, she's having sex, most of the time it's not even romantic, she's having sex with a white man. Or she's oohing and out over a white man or complimenting a white man or pursuing a white man. And if you see black men, they're not with black women at all. So black people are sitting here in front of the TV set and movie screens, and they're seeing this, you know, and they're seeing this constant thing of us not being together, of degrading each other. Because that's what really most black movies seem to be about, black male-female conflict. If there's a couple in there and they're black, it's always about conflict. Somebody abandoned somebody else. Somebody threw somebody's baby out the window. Some man's got to raise his child alone because no good black woman ain't around. You know, just on and on and on. So I think our obsession with watching so much television and movies, and I watch it too, I think it has done a huge amount of damage to the conflict between black men and women.
Amen. I would agree wholeheartedly and would encourage. I think Dr. Welsing, she used to say, reading is more important than watching television for that exact reason. The white supremacy programming is strong from the entertainment field. And just making it blatant with those type of reports, in my opinion, the contempt for gender. I think that's what Mr. Fuller calls it, spreading and normalizing that sexual confusion. One of the trends I've also noted is that there seem to be a lot more movies, TV shows, like mainstream, that are directly dealing with racism. Like Charles Barkley just had a new TNT series that was directly about racism. They had the word white supremacy in the segment. W. Kamau Bell, who's been on this program, has a new CNN show about racism. Blackish, they've been bringing up racism. They even got complaints that they were talking about racism too much, even though it's a goofy sitcom, in my opinion, on ABC. It's just tons and tons and tons of these programs, movies coming out. Get Out is still getting all of this buzz. Why do you think, what is the reason why whites would have so many different TV shows, movies on racism be mainstream and getting a lot of attention right now?
I just feel that I have never seen a time in the media that is so dangerous. And I think that when you see a victim on the ropes, you close it for the kill. I mean, there's almost no pushback from the imagery, the empire. Now they got some new show coming out, Claws. I just happened to see a commercial. I'm definitely not watching it. But it's, you know, just a bunch of women, from what I can see, some black, I guess some white, you know, just dressed up like, I hate to say it, like whores. And talking about violence and all this other kind of stuff. So I think this is the most dangerous. The media, the programming is so dangerous, but I do think it serves a purpose. It's leading up to something. What that something is anybody's guess. But I do think that they want to get people, black people especially, to a point where the moral foundation is so weak and the self-respect is so lacking that you won't fight anything that comes down the pike. You have no resistance. You know, and they push this transgender thing. You know, it looks like to me, and I hope I don't offend anybody, and if I do, let me know, but it seems to me that the transgender and the homosexual position is portrayed as more normal and desirable than the heterosexual position or lifestyle. You know, it's as though you're a hero because you're a transgender. You're a hero because you're a homosexual. That your life in and of itself is some great heroic feat that people need to acknowledge and compliment and congratulate you on. And I'm thinking, like, I never had anybody congratulate me for being a heterosexual. So I'm just saying, this is the most dangerous. It's so dangerous to me now in the last 4 years, that it's scary to me. And quite honestly, it really just, it's increased my feeling of powerlessness because I know how powerful it is. I know that most people watch television and movies. I know that I watch. And the thing that disturbs me even more, if you watch it, you need to at least be thinking about what you're looking at. And the majority of people I know, they don't think about anything. I've actually had people say, oh, it's just entertainment. I don't want to do nothing thinking when I'm looking at it. Huh? So I think they're moving people toward a point, particularly black people toward a point where they're going to, where something's going to happen politically. And the people will have very little resistance to whatever comes down the pike. They're not going to have any resistance to it.
Context of white supremacy. The trial. Speaking of television, there was once this black person who had a really popular television show, but now he's on trial for allegedly sexually abusing a number of females. Former legend, now. I don't even know the correct word dealing with all of these allegations, Bill Cosby, that they've had the jury selection pool this weekend. From what I saw, there are a lot of white people. They had a big kerfuffle about including or excluding a black female juror yesterday. They had a big write-up in the Washington Post and a number of other outlets about the jury selection process and just Mr. Cosby, I think a few weeks ago, gave a rare interview where he said that he thought racial bias was playing a role in why he was being subjected to these criminal prosecutions. What are your thoughts now that it looks like we're getting closer to the trial phase and all this? What are your thoughts on that case?
I think I was very disturbed by the fact that, and actually a news commentator said this, that it was, I don't know the exact words they used, but I got the impression what they were saying was it was legal to exclude black jurors because they were black. I'm pretty sure I heard him say something like that. And I thought to myself, it's legal to exclude black jurors because they're black? So I think at the time that I heard they had one juror, one black person chosen who was an alternate juror. Is that what you heard too?
Well, the most recent one that I looked at, they didn't have the alternates picked yet. They were still trying to get the 12.
Okay. Maybe I got that wrong as far as before I heard there was one juror that was black, I thought. And then I remember hearing something about, maybe they were saying they were going to be picking the alternate. But I do think it's Bill Cosby, be he guilty or innocent. I don't believe the trial is about that. I don't believe him being, you know, because they knew about it. You know, I had heard those rumors about Bill Cosby for over 15 years, and I had heard about it for a long time. Matter of fact, from what I understand, he learned it from Hugh Hefner. Assuming that is true, Hugh Hefner had the people in the mansion. They were doing it all the time, drugging women and having sex with them. So it made me wonder, why Bill Cosby? Why now? Do they need another black chicken to parade out in front of the white people? I don't know, but I am disturbed by it in the sense that I feel it's some political agenda. Now, if he's guilty, yeah, he should be punished, no doubt about it. But I don't think that's why he's. I don't think that's what it's about. And I'm not saying he's innocent because I don't know, but I don't think it's about him doing what he did 15, 20, 30 years ago. I don't think it's about that. I think it's something else, and I do think it's politically motivated, that he stepped on the wrong toes. I do remember vaguely that shortly before that, and I hope I got the timeline right, Bill Cosby made a statement that said that the black Muslims should be a role model because they because of how they, you know, the emphasis on family, you know, or you know their position on family. And then it seemed like maybe 2 or 3 months later, then I heard he was being, you know, so I don't know. But I do feel it's politically motivated. There's some agenda, I believe, behind it. What do you think?
Well, I excuse me. I double-checked. The jury was just announced. This was within the last hour, so this is almost, you know, information coming out since we've been on the air live. So the New York Times, they're reporting that two members of the jury, the final 12, have been selected. And they said, I'll just give you the paragraph. A 12-member jury has been selected for Bill Cosby's criminal trial as both sides agreed on two final members on Wednesday after clashing over the panel's racial makeup. Two members of the jury are African-American, a man and a woman, both in their 30s or 40s, who, like other jurors selected, said they could be fair in the sexual assault case against Mr. Cosby. The other 10 jurors appear to be white. The jury has a total of 7 men and 5 women, a majority of whom appear to be between the ages of 20 and 40. There are 2 women in their 50s and 60s and 1 man in his 70s or 80s. The racial aspect of the jury became a point of contention late Tuesday during the second day of the selection process in the Allegheny County Courthouse in Pittsburgh. Mr. Cosby's lawyers objected when the prosecution blocked an African-American woman from the jury, even though she said she could serve fairly.
Mm-hmm.
I will stop there. Anything, any additional comments you want to make about the jury selection process? Or
no, because I hadn't been following it, but I did hear that today. That so you're saying that they eliminated her?
Well, that was from, I guess they blocked a African-American female yesterday, it says.
Okay.
But ultimately, when they finished things today, there are 2 black people on. One is a black female. One is a black male.
Okay.
But the one yesterday,
okay.
black, they did block the black female yesterday.
Okay. Okay. Oh, well, I don't know. It's a sad end to the life that he had. It's a very sad end. I don't know. But it's not surprising. It's not surprising. I build you up and then I knock you down. And like I said, I'm not defending him. I don't know. If he's guilty, yeah, he should be punished. However, I just don't believe that's the reason that they've waited this long to do it. I just don't believe it. It doesn't make sense to me. Because that story has been out there for well over a decade.
Absolutely.
So I don't know what's going on with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think when the Ray Rice situation happened a few years back, that was the black male football player formerly with the Baltimore Ravens, and the video was released, savage, horrendous video of him assaulting his now wife. At the time, she was his girlfriend. And they said when they released it that they had that video for 6 months. They just sat on it for a while and then decided to release it. And at the point that they released it, I think was right in the middle of everything around Eric Garner, Michael Brown, because all that happened in the summer of 2014. It was right in the middle of that. And then they wait and release the video, almost similar to the Cosby trouble coming up in the middle of after the Michael Brown and Eric Garner. As that was picking up and there were more protests and all, if people remember everything towards the end of the summer and the fall of 2014, that's when this really picked up and became, oh, yeah, we're going to have some, you know, legal. You might have to answer for some of these, you know, rumors. Mr. Cosby was right around that time. I say all that just to say, I've said consistently, whites, they can wait, even though Mr. Cosby, as you said, he may have done exactly what he's been accused of. I don't know. Racists.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you're saying. They're not motivated by, oh, yes, we're out to pursue justice. And Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Cosby or anybody else who's committed a wrong, we want to go at it. That's not what this is at all. It'll just be, oh, yeah, if he did it, it could be, oh, yeah, we knew that nigga was doing this for 30, 40 years. You know, we didn't really care. He
mm-hmm.
was doing stuff to help us out. And system is
right.
Now that, you know, nigga that's been doing that, now it's in our interest to go and, you know, we're going to make some trouble
mm-hmm.
with that nigga and maybe even
mm-hmm.
take back a whole lot of the money that we allowed him to have and ruin his whole image and everything else since he was in service to us. Now that's not needed. We can tear all that down. I think racists have a history of doing, functioning exactly in that sort of way. It doesn't exonerate the non-white person if they did do something incorrect. And he's, I think it says mm-hmm. something about you're supposed to be innocent till proven guilty, I think, is how it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. So he might be innocent. But
that's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's not racist's concern. That is neither here nor there, whether he did anything. I think they have totally separate objectives. But, you know, I could be in error.
No, I totally agree with you. I think there's an agenda, always an agenda. I've watched this happen, particularly in Illinois and in the Chicago area, where they'll build up. It happens a lot with black politicians. Oh, it happens all the time. They'll build them up and build them up. Like Barbara Byrd, she was put in by Rahm Emanuel to head the school, to be over Chicago Public Schools. And as soon as she served her purpose, which was to mask the racism that was going on, you know, they come out with this thing where she took a bribe. Well, they already knew about the bribe before, you know, so, matter of fact, they probably gave her the bribe. So it's like now she's going to jail. She's going to prison for something that's just business as usual. I'm not saying she didn't do anything wrong. Yes, she did something wrong. But it's almost like black people are led down this road where they think they're part of the system. They think they're in the mix, and they think that they can function as white people. And then every once in a while, just for fun, or just because it's politically expedient or desirable or some other reason, they decide, well, let's go. It's like a person going out and having a fox hunt. Hey, let's get the boys together, get on the horse, and go run down a fox. So it's almost like, I think, fun and entertaining, but I think it also has a political agenda, and perhaps the overall agenda is no matter what we give these black people, look at them. They just can't do right. So I've just watched it a lot politically in this state. You know, I mean, for very little things, very little bribes. One guy, he had a bribe under $10,000, and they went after him like white on rice. And so, I mean, millions of dollars in bribes to go through this state every year. So I think that it's just built into the system. And in Bill Cosby's case, maybe there was a bigger political agenda. I don't know. But I don't think they're going after him because of what he did. I don't think they care about what he did, because he wasn't the only one doing it. That was standard operating procedure at that mansion, at the Hugh Hefner mansion. A lady even wrote a book about it, about how that was just common practice. And that was before Bill Cosby got charged. She wrote the book. So I'm just saying that I don't know exactly whose toes he stepped on, or whether he's just an expendable, or whether it's time just to cut him down the size, or whether he's going to try to buy NBC again. I don't know what's going on. Or whether he gave Farrakhan and his group a compliment, I don't know. But it's the same story, Gus, over and over again. Build you up and knock you down. Build you up and knock you down.
For fun, as you stated. All for racist fun and entertainment. Also, because, and I thought it was important, you said often victims, any of us, Gus T, put me in there too, can be fooled where you think, you know, you're doing well, or you think you can do some of the same things that racists do, get the same result, you don't get in trouble or what have you, where a lot of us can be tricked within the system. And I told you that, you know, we've had some listeners who've called in who are married currently to white people, and have begun to realize, like, man, I think I might have made a major error. I think my spouse is a racist. And, you know, trying to process that. What does that mean, and what to do? There were kind of two components. We've had a number of listeners, not just one, who've called in and confessed that that's their situation or close to their situation. The first portion is, a lot of times I've found people are not very sympathetic. Black people are not very sympathetic if it's a black person in this position. Like, it'll just kind of be not everybody, but a number of black people will kind of take the position where it's, hey, that's your choice. You know, you messed up. You wanted to go marry your cracker. You got him now. So, you know, whatever problems, that's your bed. You made your bed. Lay in it with your white man, or lay in it with your white woman. That's, you know, that's your problems. I don't care. Whatever problem, the family is racist and they're racist and they're calling you nigger and whatever else, you know, you got what you deserve. Ha ha. I've heard that a lot from, you know, non-white people, victims addressing other victims in that predicament. Just can you speak to the importance of having some patience? We do say victim for a reason.
Oh, my goodness. what a question to ask somebody like me, because I've been guilty of saying it privately. You know, I've been guilty of saying it, like, well, you know, oh, well. And I realized that's wrong. Because if I was going to make a list of all the mistakes I've made regarding personal decisions, regarding even my functioning among racists, I mean, how can I really say anything? So I think it feeds the flame of anti-blackness. It feeds the flame of or the monster of being of lacking empathy for other black people. And clearly, it's a case of amnesia, because I don't think there's anybody listening to the sound of my voice who has not, cannot look back on some things that they did in the presence of a racist or racism in general that they don't look back on and say, wow, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. I don't think there's anybody out here who has not made huge mistakes, and I mean mistakes in the sense that you can look back at it now and say, what was I thinking? And some really big mistakes, you know, where we've tricked on other black people. We've said things about black people to appease racists. We've overlooked things that racists have said and done. You know, that white validation is huge, huge, huge. So the only thing I would say is when you find yourself doing that, try to cut it off. Try to cut the thought off. You know, just try to cut the thought off. Maybe saying they're a victim doesn't work for some people, but maybe just saying, do I want to be judged by the same yardstick for the mistakes I've made? You know, it's very hard to be in this kind of society and not make those kind of mistakes. And it depends on how you grow up. You have to look at how people grew up. Everybody didn't grow up in a black environment. A lot of people grew up in environments that were predominantly white. Or they grew up in a family in which white validation was just like serving oatmeal at breakfast. Or maybe they grew up in a situation that was so dysfunctional that being amongst black people became so painful and distasteful that they looked for something else. Because it's hard dealing with us. And when you're dealing in environments that are dysfunctional and you're surrounded by dysfunctional black people, you can start to think that a white person might be a better solution or might be a solution, period. So the only thing I can say is just keep it, you know, just try to rein it in and understand that if you want people to see you as a victim, or not a victim necessarily, but as somebody deserving compassion, you got to show some compassion too. And I have to work on that because the stuff I see gets on my nerves. And the crazy thing is I'm doing stuff that if I really looked at it, I get on my own nerves. So it's just a daily struggle. I mean, you just have to work at it. You just have to really work on yourself. Your biggest problem is not other black people, it's you. That's the biggest project you ever gonna have is yourself. Not trying to convince or persuade or move or retrain other black people. You got it. Your biggest problem is retraining yourself.
Absolutely. When the charity begins at home, criticism should begin at home too. I think is super important because I think everybody is human and, you know, makes judgments and what have you. That's all of us, I think. But I think very important. If you want to be judgmental in any of those tragic arrangement situations, the white person, like everything else, is most to blame. That is the person that you should be upset with, because that is the person who is less confused about what's happening in that arrangement and why it is incorrect and tragic. That is the person that you should be upset with. The other portion of these, as I said, we have, you know, listeners, people who might even be listening right now, married a white person, you know, have been with them for a long time. And, you know, have begun to realize, have listened to some of your work, read Interracial Con Game, heard some of Dr. Welsing. What are, I guess, some of the things that you would tell them as they try to work through? Because this is something that we've talked about before on the program personally. You saying, you know, haven't dealt with it in your family as well. Just any words or suggestions that you would offer them in terms of how they can process through this and try to reestablish their black self-respect?
One thing I think they should do is give themselves credit for the fact that they've acknowledged that they may have made a mistake, and also give themselves credit for trying to find a way out of the mistake. I think it takes a lot of courage, being a black person, to acknowledge that you're being fooled and duped by a white person. And I think for you to acknowledge that you made that kind of mistake, I think that takes courage. And so I say, first of all, give yourself credit for having the courage to acknowledge what's going on. I mean, it's very hard to talk about somebody mistreating you, even if it's another black person. When I think of some of the relationships that I've had and some of the stupid stuff I put up with, I didn't tell anybody at the time because I just felt so stupid. It was embarrassing and humiliating. So to me, for you to go, and when you add a white person to the mix, it just can come across where you are not going to get any empathy. You know, you're going to be judged. You know, so you might be with a black person in a bad relationship, and people might say, oh, that was stupid, you shouldn't have done it. But when you talk about the fact you're going through it with a white person, a lot of the sympathy goes out the window. So I say give yourself credit for acknowledging, for having the courage to come forward and say something. And the other thing is, don't condemn yourself. You're a human being. You're in a white supremacy system. Everybody's confused. The white person that you're with is probably the least confused person. And it's understandable that you could fall into that situation. But I would say to someone, once you realize that's your situation, then it's incumbent upon you to get out of that situation. And if you're with an abusive person, period, you need to get out of that situation. But when there's a white person, the damage is a whole different level. It's a whole entirely different level. Because the malice is just something that you know, for a person to be a racist, abusive racist, and to marry a black person, what kind of mindset could this person possibly have? They're very dangerous psychologically. Because they know exactly what they're doing, and they know why they got with you. So I think it's really sinister to be with a white person who knows, who practices racism, and yet marries a black person. That's about as sinister as you can get. So you're dealing with evil, and you need to get out of it. Don't screw around. Don't let money be the problem. Don't let money be your stopping point. Get out of it. You are incumbent to get out of it. Because the longer you stay, the sicker you're going to get. And so I would say once you realize you're in that situation, it's your job now to get out of it. Because you're not just dealing with an ordinary dysfunctional person. You're dealing with something that's sinister on the level that you can't even imagine. Because I have more respect for a racist that say I'd never marry a black person. A racist, outward racist, who marries a black person is pretty scary to me. That means that they have an intent to do some damage. So it's incumbent upon you to get out of it, you know.
Generational damage. If offspring come in and then impacting the other family members, because I think that is one of the points that I think you bring out in the interracial con game, and something that we've observed as well, the isolating these victims and these tragic arrangements. The white person will get that black person, male or female, will get married with them and move out someplace in the boondocks where it's no other black people, so they can make it really, really difficult in a variety of ways in terms of how they're wreaking damage on you and destroying those bonds, eroding those relationships with other black family members, other black friends. That's been a huge pattern that I've observed. So just kind of keep that in mind in terms of how they function when they come in and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to marry this black person. They have a racist agenda for sure.
Yes. Wow. I mean, that's really sick. That's just sick to me, that you would dislike black people would you decide to marry a black person. Oh.
Absolutely. And the sexual intercourse on top of it. We know it's been tons of that as well going on for, you know, eons. Before I get to some of the folks who dialed in, I did want to ask as well, you mentioned the difficulty, I guess, of being in an area where you're around a lot of black people, a high concentration of black people, a lot of victims, you know, doing what victims do, being confused about racism and a lot of anti-blackness. I guess what is most challenging about that environment for you to be in, and what counter-racist techniques have you figured out or worked on to try to help you and how you relate to other black people in that environment?
I'll tell you one big problem is you become, oh, it's a terrible word, but almost contemptuous. You know, because you see so much craziness. And you almost become, you know, it's like intolerant. And there are times when, you know, when I'm around stuff where it's real, where it's just, oh, my goodness. You know, just openly, outwardly, just disrespectful. Just people not respecting each other, not respecting themselves. And then when I look at them sometimes, you know, other black people, particularly strangers, I start to feel bad because it's sad. It's sad to see the state of mind that's out here. So it's depressing, and I try to struggle with my own attitude because I don't. You know, if you knew me, if you met me in person, I don't this is my opinion. I've never had anybody tell me different. I try to be respectful of people, and I try to be compassionate of people. But what's in my head sometimes is like, it's not as nice as the outward. So I find myself judging. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge. I think I can understand why a black person might move away from an urban area or might go to some place where there's not huge concentrations of people, period. Because to be honest with you, when I'm in concentrations with a lot of white people and it's very concentrated, it gets on my nerves too. So it's not just black people. I think it's just the urban environment that makes people very high-strung, makes people very nervous, very antisocial. Behavior. So I don't think it's just a black thing. I think being in an environment where people are under a lot of pressure. Things are crowded, there's traffic, you know, you can't hardly move because you go someplace, there's a line someplace. So I would say the thing I try to keep in mind is this is still a person, and this is still a person who I don't know where they came from. I don't know what they've gone through. I don't know if they've experienced. And I think the best thing that I try to do is not create conflict. Try to stay out of conflict with people. Like Mr. Fuller said, if you have to minimize contact and minimize conflict, that's what you do. And I think minimizing contact means don't have conversations and disagreements and arguments with people when you don't have to, particularly with strangers. You know, and so you can minimize physical contact, but you can also minimize verbal contact. And that means I'm not going to say anything that's going to lead to a conflict. If I see this person in line and they're doing something stupid or rude, I'm just going to ignore it, which is what I try to do because I don't know where your head is at. I don't know what you might how you might respond. But I also know that whatever's going on with you, I don't want to make it worse. So I think, you know, you try to maintain some compassion in the sense of whatever this person's going through, I don't want to add to it. And I think that's possibly the best way that I function with it is whatever's like at work. Oh, I work with other crazy people. Oh, my God. But I feel like I don't know what kind of challenges you had. So I think about that. I go back and say, I don't know what kind of childhood this person had. You know, I don't know what kind of abuse they may have suffered. I don't know what kind of bad experiences they had. So, just don't add to it. Don't add to it. Whatever victimization they experienced, just make sure you don't add anything to it. And that's about the only way I can function is trying not to add. And also, if you can say something nice to somebody, if you can show a courtesy, I think that's super important. If it means just holding the door, if it means just being courteous to somebody, you never know if that might make them feel good for that minute. So I would say just try not to be add to whatever problem it is. Try not to add nothing else negative to a situation if you can help it, you know. But that's how I try to function, you know.
Wow.
I've been staying home a lot.
That minimized contact, that can be helpful, or at least, as you stated, not having just like idle, we're just going to just hang out for the purpose of hanging out, just sitting around chit-chatting about nothing, like, you know, having a specific purpose, reason, something that constructed that we're trying to do, and if it's not about that, then cutting down a lot of that, because I found that often, and I think Mr. Fuller said this too, when you just sitting around and chatting up about nothing in particular, like that can stray off into conflict you can't even imagine. but just monitoring that, and then I think too, as you said, just I'm not gonna add to it. That's something I try and keep in mind too. If it's a black person, like, man, I know racists are terrorizing this person just like they're terrorizing me. I'm going to do my best to see if I cannot add to their stress or my stress. Like, I'm around them. Like, just having that in mind can be very, very helpful. And then if you all can be helpful, then that's, hey, A+, in my opinion, if you can do something to help out another non-white person.
And something, Gus, too, is that people respond to me differently when I have that mentality. I actually have people being nicer and friendlier. You know, I think having a vibe is really important, and you may not be able to control it, but I do think that sometimes people can sense that you don't have an agenda or you don't have any negative feelings. I'll give you an example. Oh, my goodness. I won't even give you an example. But anyway, I think people can pick up sometimes when you're trying to have that mentality. Doesn't mean it's always going to work. But I think you pick up on it. I just sense that, you know, like we were saying, just don't add to it. You don't know what that person is going through. Just don't add nothing to it. Let it go.
Context of white supremacy. That right there, I say that all the time. Like, people have asked, because Pam is in an area where she's around a lot of black people. I, in Seattle, am not around very many black people, so I, you know, have kind of opposite end of the spectrum, because it's heavy, heavy whites here. Very different dynamic. But that is very, very important, in my opinion, when you're in an environment where it's a lot of other black people, a lot of other non-white people, like, minimizing conflict. That does so much to work against racism, white supremacy. Like, that's not saying that you got to be in love with that black person. That's not saying that you got to go visit them every day and, you know, bring them chicken soup if they're injured. It's not saying that at all. It's just saying I'm going to try to be courteous. If I can help this person out, I will. And I'm not going to mistreat this. I'm not going to be nasty. I'm not going to be talking bad about them. I'm not going to try to add any stress or difficulties to their existence. Just that right there would be huge. I'm going to try my best to make sure I don't mistreat this person. Certainly don't do it, you know, intentionally or anything that I'm aware of, that I'm not, you know, mistreating this person. I'm going to try my best not to be deceitful with this person, tell them the truth. Just that right there would go a long way to putting white people out of business, because so much, Dr. Welsing talked about this all the time, so much of what they do is dependent on us being in conflict and mistreating other black people, including ourselves.
I'll tell you something that, speaking on that, I'll tell you how powerful it is and how black people are operating at a much less aware level than white people. I'll give you an example. One time I was on a train. It's a metro. It's like a commuter train, and it travels between the city and different suburbs. And this black lady got on. I think I might have been like maybe five stops away from where I was getting off to go home. And it was like maybe early evening, like maybe 4:30, something like that. And so this black lady got on. She had some luggage. And so she was struggling with it. She was sweating. She was fussing at people. I don't really know why. I just happened to hear her fussing. And I don't know if she was fussing legitimately or not. But I could just see this sister was stressed out. And I saw the white people frowning at her and stuff like that. So there were no seats on the train. And so when I saw her and I saw she had all this stuff, I got up from my seat. And I said, why don't you take the seat? You know? And so she took the seat. And I could just see she was stressed out. Well, I got these looks. And I was standing by the door because you always get off like five stops or something. And I could see people looking at me. And I kind of sensed what it was like, not so much I had done the wrong thing, but that I had come to this black person's aid. Rather than sit there and judge her and be negative because she was fussing and everything, it was like I had stepped out of that, and I didn't approach, it wasn't like I was a human being helping another human being. I was a black person showing compassion toward another black person, and I could see the looks that I got, and I knew what those looks meant. It meant like, this is not the way it's supposed to go. You weren't supposed to do that. And I said, this is really powerful. If black people could just for one day, a week, decide they're going to be publicly courteous to another black person, it's power, because they don't want us to do that. They don't want us to be compassionate toward each other. They don't want us to, and I don't say that all white people walking around saying, oh, well, no black person will like no black. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying for the system to function effectively, black people must be at odds with each other. That's why they have the attack on our relationships. That's why they attack our families. That's why they don't show imagery that's positive between black males and females. It's important to keep us divided and fighting. It gives them power. It gives the system power for us to be at each other's throats. And when they see a black person who is not at each other's throat, who is actually stepping out of whatever they're in and extending a courtesy or a compassionate move toward another black person, that's a blow against the system. Because I saw when people were looking at me, I just ignored them. I just looked right over their head. I'm like, I don't care what you're looking at. You know, I mean, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I can give up my seat if I want to. I really don't care what you think. You know? But I could see that they were looking at me. And I said, yeah, you didn't think I was supposed to do that, did you? So if I, if we could just get to the habit of just being more courteous to each other, that would be so much power in that. And if you're in a relationship, if you can just step out of this for a second, out of craziness that's in your head, and be more compassionate toward that person. Because if you can't be compassionate toward the person you're with, why are you with them? Now you got to look in the mirror at yourself. Why are you with somebody you can't be compassionate with? Doesn't that indicate you got a problem? So I'm just saying, it's the way we treat each other adds either, it gives us power, it takes power away.
Context of white supremacy. Absolutely. Absolutely. Helping other black people. Helping other black people. Very, very important. Whites do not like that at all. To see anyone helping a black person, like, man, that right there, you can ruin a racist day. Help a black person. Being kind, courteous, polite, helpful to another black. Oh, my God. That is kryptonite to racist man, racist woman, and racist child. They have engineered all of this to make sure that that doesn't happen. I will step aside and allow some of the folks who dialed in to get their questions. The number is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, caller 8356, if you had a question for Pam, your line should be open. Feel free. Last four digits.
Hello.
Oh, yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? How you doing, Pam?
Hi.
Hi. One quick question. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, where you were, there was a black cop named Lowell Hauser. he shot a person named Jose Nieves. He could be white. He could not be white, depending on his last name.
Mm-hmm.
The investigation took only 16 days to be completed. And he is charged with first-degree murder. His GoFundMe page only got $10 to this day.
Hmm.
Do you think that's an example of building black people up in order to bring them down?
You know, I'm not familiar with the story. It very well could be. You know, I do say I do definitely notice that, you know, the there's very little empathy for black people, you know, in general. But yeah, that could very well could be.
Okay, the same could probably be said about the black cop Derek Stafford in Louisiana. I don't know if you know about that case. He's the one who shot the little white boy to death and just got a 55-year prison sentence.
I didn't hear what kind of sentence. I think I do remember hearing about that, but I don't remember hearing, you know, what happened to him. And that's not surprising. Not surprising at all. I mean, that goes against the whole premise of having police in the first place. You know, the police are like, you know, police are necessary. Don't get me wrong. They're a necessary part of society. But I do feel that they also serve a different function than they should, and that is to reinforce the system of white supremacy. And certainly black cops, and I used to date a cop, and certainly they, and we talk, we're still good friends to this day, and definitely there's a difference. You know, black cops know that there are lines they better not cross. And one of those lines is you better, if you got to shoot a white person, you better be real careful you didn't have any of the alternative, and you still might get it. It doesn't matter if the person is armed or not. So,
all right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Appreciate that, M1. I think this is Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Pam? Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Garth. Good evening, Pam. Nice to speak to you again. I had a couple of comments and then one quick question, if I can get it in. What you just said about the on the metro.
We have a whole lot of time for speechifying, so we could get to the questions.
All right, I'll just get to the question. In Chicago, are you seeing any different type of police out there, or maybe some security forces or anything, anything that's striking you as being odd as far as with the law enforcement? And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Okay. You know, one thing, I haven't personally seen it, but I have heard some things that made me very suspect. For example, made the whole situation. I remember when, I can't think of this guy's name, he was a police chief before McCartney, before the black guy, because we got a black police chief now. Before that, we had a guy from who came out of, I believe he was some kind of head of police of some kind during 9/11 in New York City. I think his name was McCarthy. Before him, we had an FBI guy with no police experience. And I remember thinking when that FBI guy came and he became the head of the police department, whatever, that it seemed like the random killings increased. Something strange was going on. I also was under the impression that there were covert military/police organizations operating in Chicago. Because for a while, we had people just getting shot willy-nilly. They weren't gangbangers. They weren't even young people. Person getting off the bus, 40-something years old, bam. And so it was a lot of random shooting going on that didn't make any sense to me in terms of gangbanging. And nobody ever gets caught. We got all of these cameras in these neighborhoods, but no camera ever captured anything. So I started thinking, something's not right. This FBI guy, why is he here? And secondly, why is all these random shootings happening that nobody's getting caught. Nobody's seeing any. I tell you one thing, the easiest person to catch is a gangbanger. You know why? Because they talk. You got gang informants in every gang in the country. So if somebody out here is doing a lot of gangbanging and they're killing a lot of people, the cops can easily find out who it is because you got informants. You got people getting arrested all the time who are copping pleas, who are turning over information to get a lighter sentence. So the easiest person to me to catch is a gangbanger. Most of them are unsophisticated criminals, and some are not criminals at all. They just caught up. So you got all this random shooting that's being ascribed to gangbangers, but nobody's hardly ever getting arrested. That didn't make sense to me. So I do believe there's covert military slash quasi-police types of organizations that are operating in Chicago. I really believe that. Can't prove it, but I believe something's going on here. I believe Chicago is really kind of almost being staged for martial law. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but... And then, too, when you've got large black populations, the best thing you can do is turn them against each other. And how do you do that? By making black people think that other black people are dangerous, the other black people are lawless, the other black people are animals, the other black people are worthless. I mean, there's no better weapon you can use than to turn people against each other. You don't even have to have a gun to do that because they'll destroy each other. So, yeah, I think there's something going on here.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. We'll see if we can get his comments in before we are all done today. The person who dialed in, last four digits, 7896. 7896. Did you have a question for Pam? You should be with us. Are you there? 7896. Last four digits. Not sure if they're just listening or they hit their mute button. Last check. Last. Are you with us? 7896, caller. Yes, sir. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Sorry about that. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Miss Pam. Thank you for this wonderful show and very constructive. So I got two quick questions. I'll get them off real quick, and I'll mute my line. My first question was pertaining to Bill Cosby and maybe this agenda that may be in order. So my first question is, and just thinking back in history, have we had any prominent or successful? I would say Bill Cosby may be rich or considered wealthy. Have we had any African American or non-white in this part of the land that was able to pass away and pass on their wealth to their non-white spouse or kids in history in this particular part of the land? I'm just trying to think if that's the case. And forgive me, I'm still learning, so I'll be listening to Mr. Gus and Mr. Pam on that question. My second question is pertaining to Dr. Francis Quest Welsing. And Mr. Neely Fuller. Mr. Neely Fuller says that we are in a system that is white supremacy, racism and white supremacy, that is a world global system. And we are in a war, and that they are full control of economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, if that's the case. With Dr. Quest Welsing saying that this is a chess match, and we're on a chessboard, and we're on certain sides, black and white side. Well, if that's the case, how are we going to be successful in a successful campaign in eliminating white supremacy and replacing it with justice if we have on our side, the black side, people that's committing treason, espionage, things of that nature, and not dealing with those people and eliminate those people without, that means we might have to be in conflict with people who look like us that may be in conflict with our agenda to be successful. So I'm just asking that question as well. And I'm learning from you guys. Great show, very constructive, and I'll leave my line. Thanks.
Okay. Well, if I understand the question correctly, that's the million-dollar question, is how to defeat the system of white supremacy when you have a variety of black people, a variety of different... First of all, the system is global, so you can't really run from it. I hear people talking about living in the United States, going where? Where are you going to go where there's no white supremacy? So how to eliminate it? How to deal with the black people that you think are an impedance to eliminating the system? Well, then we probably have to look at ourselves, too. You know, so I remember Mr. Fuller talking about how, you know, when the 60s and stuff, I think this is what he said, about how black people wound up hurting each other in their so-called revolutionary rhetoric and position. They wind up black people killing other black people. And I suspect that that would be the outcome if black people decide to take a hard line up against so-called quote-unquote traitors. It would just be black people killing other black people. And that's not going to solve the problem. Matter of fact, that would thrill the system because they would be like, they'll never figure this out if they decide they're going to hurt each other. So I don't know what you should do with black people that you think are a hindrance, that are traitorous. In your opinion, I don't know what anybody can do about that, because the system breeds that into people by the masses. How to defeat the system is the million-dollar question. I don't think anybody has the answer to it. I think it's just I know I don't have the answer to it. I do think individual people working on themselves helps to weaken the system. I think the decisions black people make individually can weaken the system. How you raise your children to think about themselves and about the system can you know, weaken the system. I think we have to focus on weakening the system before talking about eliminating the system. And the things that we do actually feed into the system. I talk to people all the time. I said, well, you know, you're supporting, let's say, for example, something's called red bottom shoes. I just learned about these shoes a couple of months ago. I guess somebody said Oprah Winfrey was someplace and she, underneath her, you know, I guess the bottom of her shoes were red. So a lot of black women are buying red bottom shoes for $750 a pop. Well, say a sister decided, you know what, I'm really becoming more conscious. I'm becoming more aware. I am giving this white manufacturer who probably does designer, who probably doesn't even want me to represent their brand. I'm going out here spending money close to a grand on a pair of shoes because they got red bottoms. Now, that sister could turn around and say, I'm not buying anything. I'm not buying anything. I'm not buying this designer stuff. I'm not buying $700 iPhones. I'm not going to deal with companies that that I know for a fact are using child labor or don't treat people correctly, don't treat black people correctly. That would be a counter-racist move. I had in my books, I think all four of them, different things black people could do that could oppose racism. And they were simple things, and most of them didn't cost money. They saved money, you know. So I would say individual black people making it part of their life to not feed into the system, you know, not talk bad about people, not make fun of hair, not worship skin and hair color, not talk about good hair and pretty eyes. There's a million things we could do that would weaken the system. And if you take a million people and they're all doing something to weaken the system will weaken. But I don't think there's any one thing we can do that's going to eliminate the system. I think we have to focus on weakening that. And I think the best way to do that is on an individual basis. And teaching your children different, because a lot of people don't even talk to their kids. They don't tell them about the experience. They don't tell them anything. Most black children are coming out here totally ignorant as to the system and the situations they're going to be dealing with. You know why? Because we don't want to talk about it. I don't know if it's pride or ego or hurt feelings or whatever it is. So there's a lot of things people need to do right in their own house. Stop having children we can't take care of. Stop having children with people you know you're not going to be with. There's a lot of things we could do to weaken this system. And I would say most people, everybody needs to start with themselves.
Absolutely. Criticism and charity begin at home. Say that one again. I guess my quick response before I get to the next caller, to the person's, the male's two questions, in terms of passing on wealth, if we're talking about finances or what have you, you have, I think, number one, whites, they do a pretty phenomenal job of disrupting black people's ability to pass on things of constructive value, whether it's information, finances, property, you name it. If it's something of value, racists, they do a pretty good job of prying it away from black people so that it cannot be passed on. But I'm sure there are, I mean, at this point within the system of white supremacy, they've allowed a substantial number of, you know, black people to have a few nickels. So I'm sure they've passed on a penny or two to their offspring. You've got a few second generation black entertainers, black athletes, other folks who have some coinage. So, but I mean, all of that is relative and still within the system of white supremacy. The other response, very, very popular. I hear that all the time in terms of how do we solve this problem without getting rid of or eliminating black people who are traitors, spies for racist man, racist woman. That is another very, very popular topic for many black people, many victims of racism. I would say number one, words. I don't think of another black person as a quote unquote traitor or committing espionage. That is war terminology. And I've stated consistently, black people are not at war. That's the principal reason that I do not use terms like that. We're not at war. Nobody on this call, we have not come together and said this is a meeting of the black race and we're going to have our plan, our strategy for how we are going to deal with white folks. And this is our, we didn't have that meeting. That's what, to be a traitor, you would have to enlist. I think when you have the army, you have to enlist or you get drafted. There's some sign up about, you know, these are your duties. This is what you're supposed to do. Here's your uniform. You get your, we have not done that. As black people, as a quote-unquote black race, that's why Mr. Fuller says there's only one race. White people have agreed to practice racism, white supremacy. They can be traitors to that cause and commit espionage and all that other stuff. We are just victims of racism, and I think that's very important because it makes one stop and question that whole way of how we're thinking about this. Because if you just follow logic, if you just want to go fuss at black people who are helping out racists, oh man, you can start right here probably with Gus and Pam, because I don't think you're going to find any black people who are not helping out racists in some way. So you'll have an endless list. Mr. Fuller has said that many times, and I agree. I've said that point repeatedly, and it just, in my view, it shows how popular and how common the tendency is to take the focus and attention away from racists and to put that focus on black people as opposed to trying to figure out how to neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. It's let's get at these black people who are victims, but they're helping out white people in some manner. I've seen no evidence that doing any of that helps to solve the problem. There's a lot of evidence of black people who have done that sort of thing, who got upset and said, you know, you Coon, Sambo, Uncle Toms are helping out white folks and we're going to deal with you right now. Sometimes they had to go answer to white people for doing that. And then they had to go, you know, do whatever white people said. If that meant you got to go be in a cage for the next 10 years, so be it. I would just look at the end of the day, that has been done before and that didn't solve the problem either. And exactly as Pam said, it seemed like racists love it, because then not only do we have black people fighting with each other, which I think was already stated today, that's a big part of what keeps this system together. Now we might get an opportunity to come in and clean up where the niggers have been fighting themselves, which we started to begin with. So that's my view. I don't think that solves any problems. It devotes a tremendous amount of time and energy, and there's already a considerable history of that behavior not leading to a solution. Mm-hmm. I will say it again. Criticism and charity should begin at home. The person who dialed in, I think this is Jessica. She's dialed in a number of times before. Jessica, if you had a question for Pam, you should be with us. Good to hear from you.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Hi there. Hi, Gus. Hi, Miss Pam. It's a pleasure to speak
with
you. I actually don't have a question. I have a lot of commentary. I'm in a tragic arrangement, interracial marriage, currently separated. I don't have a question, but I don't know if I'm going to go to someone who does, but I can just pass for right now or just give my commentary in terms of what I'm experiencing.
Oh, Gus is open to it. I certainly am.
Snickers at Thomas in New York. Let's hear what you've been experiencing.
What does that mean, Snickers?
I had given my speech earlier about folks speechifying. That is a lot of people's, that is another one of callers' favorite activity when we have a guest, and there are a lot of callers that they either will have a question or they won't have a question, but they'll have lots and lots of statements that they would like to make. I generally try to stop that because it gets contagious and everybody wants, you know, 5 hours to give their speech.
That's right. And that's why I wanted to run it by you. Because I could definitely go on. So if it's okay with you, then I'll continue.
Let's hear it.
Okay. So Gus is aware, but I am in a tragic arrangement with white supremacists. I didn't know until we were married, and we've been married for 2.5 years. I've just gone through a lot of verbal and emotional abuse, and it's gotten physical. Recently, and so there's an incident that happened where someone else called the police, and so I'm separated from this person at this time. But as far as the, I know you and Gus were talking earlier about just the evilness, the sheer evilness of a admitted racist to marry a black person. I mean, I've just experienced that firsthand, and so I almost cringe when I see black women with white men now, because it's a horrific, horrific position to be in. But I'm currently in the process of getting out, in the divorce process, getting back in school and getting back on my feet. Kind of thing. So.
Well, you know what? The one big comment that I would like to make, even though I know that, you know, again, you know, it is a courageous thing for you to acknowledge it. To acknowledge to us that you're in a situation, knowing that people lack sympathy for black people who do go into a tragic relationship. So I would just say, give yourself credit for at least being courageous enough to speak, because you might help someone else. And the other thing is having the courage to get out of it. And now you know you've got to get out of it. You know you've got to get out of it if you want to save yourself. So I think that's important, too, is once you acknowledge you're in that kind of situation, you got to get out. No matter what, there's no cost too high to pay to get out of that. So I would say definitely pursue as quickly as possible to get out of that, because for a person to marry you and try to harm you, that's just wickedness.
Black self-respect. That would be my only comment. I think black self-respect is recognizing when you're in a dangerous situation as a black person, and then making sure that you do all that you can to extricate yourself. I think that is an exercise, a demonstration of black self-respect. I think when black self-respect has been annihilated, we tolerate, put up with things that are completely like 5,000% unacceptable, like some racist, verbally and physically abusive white man that is allegedly supposed to be your husband, quote unquote. That is totally unacceptable. Black self-respect would demand it.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, we all make mistakes. We all make mistakes. Don't pulverize yourself over it. Because some people never acknowledge that they made a mistake, and they stay in those relationships. So, you know, it was a mistake. We all make mistakes. And forgive yourself and just be glad that you saw for yourself that this was a situation that you're dealing with a racist, white supremacist. So that's important. And now you move forward, you can do something different. You can do something that's more self-respecting and something that's better for you. But I give you, like I said, I respect the fact that you have the courage to say it, to own it, and to acknowledge that it was a mistake. So forgive yourself and move on and leave.
I think what was most traumatizing, and what I've learned certainly from the show and throughout the process of this marriage, I thought that the more educated, you know, the person is, the less likely they are to be racist. I married a physician, a doctor, and just the stuff that I've gone through, I mean, it's just, it's horrific. I have recordings of the things that he's called me and the things that he's put me through. And it's just, it's dangerous on every level. And I can definitely, I will definitely strongly encourage any Black person to not get in an interracial marriage, like, whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just, my last comment would just be that it's education. I know we've all been taught this, that a white supremacist is a skinhead or a Ku Klux Klanger or somebody ignorant. You know, it was taught that racist white people were pretty much ignorant white people, poor white trash, whatever you want to call it. We were taught to have a certain visual image of them. We weren't taught that they could be educated, doctors, lawyers, senators, prominent people. We weren't taught that. We were taught to see them as an aberration of white society, you know, of the physical manifestation of a guy with a robe and a hood on his head, when in reality, those people couldn't do it by themselves. They're basically the foot soldiers for the people who do have education and power and influence. So a white supremacist can be anybody, a soccer mom. It could be a senator. It could be the president. It could be anybody. So that's the one thing that, you know, I try to emphasize in the books is you can't tell who's a racist white supremacist by the educational status or anything. You have to, a lot of times you don't know who the racist white supremacist is until they expose themselves. But, and I would like to make this offer to you because I think it's important for people to share their experiences because there may be somebody else in the same boat or it's considering the same boat. If you're ever interested in telling your story, and you want to post it on a blog, you are welcome to post it on my blog. So if you ever feel that, you know, it's like an essay or something you want to write and share with people you think is constructive, you are free to, you know, to send it to me. You don't have to identify yourself. You can make up a fake, you know, fake email. People do Gmails. You can make up Gmail email in a second. And you can send it to me with any information you want, any, you know, audio, whatever you want, and I'll post it on my blog so that other people can learn from your experience. So that's up to you. I'm just making the offer. So that's all. It's my last comment.
Have you checked out the Interracial Con Game, Jessica?
I have, actually. I've read that in the Beauty Con Game.
Awesome. Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Great reading material can be helpful for folks in those situations. Definitely appreciate you having the courage, as Pam stated, to step forward and share, and Black self-respect to step forward and share. I know that is not the most fun to have to step forward publicly and talk about that sort of thing, but I it's helpful. There are other folks who are in your position, and I think it's helpful for all of us to get a better understanding of this problem and just trying to learn so we can all do better. So definitely thank you for dialing in, and hopefully we will hear from you as you continue through the process.
Thanks,
Gus. Let's see.
Let me just say this. Take care of yourself. Look out for yourself and get out. That's my last words.
Black self-respect and safety is very important. Person who called in from a blocked number, 2812, did you have a question for Pam?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, good evening, guys. Hey, Pam, how are you?
Good evening.
Good evening. My question is that I'm going to refer Mr. Fuller. I'm sure that you've been in your area of Chicago. A lot of the results of some of the non-white people's behavior has come from a lot of what I think what Mr. Fuller calls specifically from the male sexually motivated show-offism, like Dr. Wilson calls it. You know, when you play with sex, you know, the joke is on the offspring. You know, as a Black male, I can tell you, you know, previously engaged, I now see the damage of that, and it destroys families, it hurts other Black people, and it further strengthens the system of racism, white supremacy. My first question is that, this is your opinion, do you think that Black males spend that much energy in trying to engage in that non-constructive sexual behavior is because we basically think we can't solve this problem and that we have no power and that we just simply want someone to dominate. And then I'll ask my second question.
Okay, I do think that the collective behavior is an acknowledgement of powerlessness. I can't control anything around me, but I can't control my penis. Well, I can't control my penis. And I'm going to use my penis to, you know, my physical size or my penis or something to make myself feel powerful, to a way to affirm myself. I've actually had males say that having more children made them more of a man. So whether they took care of the children or with the children didn't matter. It was the idea of having, being able to procreate. So I do think a lot of our behavior comes straight out of our experiences during that 400-year period of slavery and the damage to our self-esteem and self-image. It's still alive and well, and it's getting even more damaged now because the media images are so dangerously negative and so deceptive that I do think that, yeah, it has a lot to do with a sense of powerlessness. Powerlessness breeds rage, and it breeds what I would call non-constructive behavior.
Absolutely. Gus, can I ask another question, please?
Yes, sir.
Okay. My second question is that in, like, what you just mentioned in media, what I've noticed over the last just couple of years is that the system of race and white supremacy actually describes the group ISIS as the greatest threat to the West, partially because they take their religion so seriously. And everywhere you look, they are showing these quote-unquote non-white Muslims as being very, very serious about their religion, about what they're trying to do. When they say America, I just say they're talking about what they're trying to do to white people. I don't believe that they're saying that stuff, saying black people aren't involved in any of it. My question to you is the visuals that they show of these Muslims compared to the visuals that they show towards specifically black people, is this something that racists are doing to basically tell white people that we need to take these people more seriously than black people? Do you think that's something that they could possibly be doing? Because I never see them describing black people as being anything else than goofy and non-serious. But they go out of their way and they spend millions of dollars to create programming, television shows, and networks that specifically show these non-white Muslims as the greatest threat to white supremacy. So that was my question.
Okay. I personally think black people should take no comfort in the overexposure of brown people, a.k.a. Muslims. I think we should take no comfort. They haven't taken the bullseye off us. The biggest bullseye, the biggest laser point is on us. They don't portray us that way because politically it's not necessary right now. They're taking care of us in a whole different way. I do believe that a lot of what we're hearing and seeing about the quote-unquote Muslims are lies. I believe that a lot of the things they've been blamed for have actually been the works of the white supremacists. And I would tell people that if you look back throughout all these so-called terrorist events, you will see a common denominator of the people that they're accusing not having the sophistication or the ability to carry out these things that they're saying. So I would say, I don't know what's really going on, but I would tell you this. They've got, you know, there's an agenda. And the agenda, I believe, is a white rallying cry for white people. They're rallying white people toward black people in a different way. You know, first of all, they're not going to show black people as being powerful. Black people don't have a global political stage on which to put us on. They don't need to do that. They've got us under control right now. They deal with us in the same inhumane way. The only difference is it's just a whole different way of, you know, in other words, they have one way of dealing with us, another way of dealing with the Muslims. The bottom line is they're all non-white people. And this is a march toward global white supremacy to finally get to its point where it has everybody under its thumb, economically, resource-wise, psychologically-wise. They want to control the whole planet. So what they have to do is they have to eradicate those elements that might offer resistance, be it Russia, be it China, be it Muslim countries, be it practicing Muslims. They have to demonize everybody because their agenda is to have a one-world government. So you have to destroy a government and people's culture before you could have that. So I believe that's one agenda that they have that's being directed at those people. The other agenda is being directed, literally, at making black people so non-essential. Black people are so trivialized now, almost to be unimportant. Most of the imagery of us is negative, is derogatory. It shows us as worthless human beings. Jerry Springer, Maury Povich, Empire, whatever you want to look at. All these comedians being stupid, you know, all this negative programming, black women with blonde weaves, with red fingernails two inches long. All this is about making black people appear to be so insignificant. We've been trivialized to a degree that I've never seen before. They don't even put us on television in commercials. We don't see brown people hardly. The only time I see a brown person in a commercial, for the most part, it'll be a brown-skinned black male surrounded by white people. White guy's his best buddy. Or he's sitting there in a room or being a table at a restaurant, and he's sitting with a bunch of white people. That's the only time I see black people, brown-skinned black people. I see a brown-skinned black man with a biracial, so-called racially ambiguous woman. Or he'll be with just a bunch of white people. But you don't see black couples. You don't see dark-skinned babies. You don't see brown and dark-skinned children. You don't see brown and dark-skinned women. So what I'm saying is we've trivialized to the point of almost being insignificant. And I think they feel that at this point we are insignificant. We don't even merit a terrorist image because we're already conquered. In their minds, they got us doing homosexuality, they got us doing transgender, they got us all sexually confused, they got us fighting each other, they got us spending money we don't have, they got us so that our biggest businesses are churches. Most successful business in black America is a church. A church that produces nothing. Big old buildings, nobody's doing anything but having a church in it. Go to a black community anywhere, full of businesses from people just off the boat. We don't produce anything. We don't make anything. We don't employ ourselves. We can't employ ourselves. And we're spending money like North going 40, buying $700 phones and $800 shoes with red bottoms on them. We're trivial. I don't believe we even, they're not worried about us. The only time I think they would get worried about us is if we started changing our behavior. In some way significant. Large numbers of black people started changing what they did. Said, listen, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not going to participate in that anymore. I don't have to pick up a weapon. I'm just going to use what I would call the theory of non-participation. Stop participating in those things that degrade you. That means stop supporting movies that degrade black people. They had a movie several years ago. I was so appalled by it. Black movie. I think it was Ice Cube or somebody else. And they were some kind of black guys doing something or other, and they decided they're going to rob a black church. I forget the name of the movie, but people probably recognize it. So they had a scene. I just happened to, for some reason, it was on YouTube or something. I just happened to catch a preview or something. And they had gone in there with guns in the church. And they had turned the church into a mockery. The black people in the church was acting silly. The black guys coming in there robbing the church. And I said to myself, could I imagine this scene playing out in a Jewish synagogue where it was a comedy of some robbers coming in and disrespecting and pistol-whipping Jewish people in a synagogue? And I said, I couldn't imagine that. So what I'm saying is they got us participating in all this foolishness, watching movies, paying money to see ourselves degraded. Empire, paying money to see ourselves degraded. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get off on a roll, but I said, I think we're so trivialized now. They're worried about us. That's what I think. But they are keeping an eye on us to make sure we don't get our act together, to make sure we don't change our mindset and start thinking. They are concerned about that. So they're doing everything they can to make sure we stay trapped in this foolish mindset that we're in. But if we started changing that, they would sit up and pay attention. We wouldn't be trivial anymore. Because actually, in many respects, there must be something potentially powerful about black people in this country particularly, they wouldn't spend so much time and energy trying to make sure that we never develop our potential. So there must be something they know about us. And also when you look at black people collectively, black people have been the vanguard of almost every social movement in this country. So But black people, when we get to act together, when black people put their thinking caps on, black people are a powerful force. And so they're aware of that, and they're going to make sure that doesn't happen, that we don't get our minds right. I don't know if that answered your question, because I went on a roll, so I apologize for that.
She got on Empire and lost train of everything.
Oh man, I lost it. I lost it. It's like a thorn in my foot.
It was over. I knew as soon as that came up, it was
over.
Oh
yeah,
I'm sorry. Done deal.
Oh my God. Okay. I apologize. I just can't take it.
I feel you. we will nab the person that called in last four digits 5771. 5771. Did you have a question for Pam?
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, Pam. As a fellow Chicago resident, I have traveled to Metra, and I've had a similar experience that you did, because that train line is filled with racist white women. So,
true enough.
And you
true.
Already know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that police chief that you were thinking about, that was Jody Weed. And you also okay. mentioned about proof about unmerited murders. Well, the Chicago mm-hmm. Tribune last year said that 70% of the gun rape murders in Chicago were unsolved. So that mm-hmm. right there tells me that there's something else is going on. But my mm-hmm. question to you is, since you know Chicago a lot, you obviously know that there are a lot of non-white Arabs and non-white Koreans
mm-hmm.
in black neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and in particular the non-white Arabs who have liquor stores, who are selling more than just, you know, bad food, but also drugs and guns.
Mm-hmm.
What is the codified response to a situation like that, since they are, you know, they are non-white people, but they are particularly serving the best interests of white supremacy against, you know, black people? What is the codified response against them?
I personally don't know what the codified response would be, but if I knew I was going into a business and I suspected they were selling more than fried fish or soda pop, and I suspected they were dealing with illegal weapons or guns or something like that, or drugs, I wouldn't patronize the store. So we have a lot more power than we think. A lot of it is just we are so used to being disrespected that disrespect does not make us come up with a different alternative. You know, we go to these stores, they're selling inferior stuff, they're selling bad food, they're doing all kinds of stuff. To me, if I had to say codified response, it would be not to patronize their store. As far as telling the police, police already know. So, because I'm convinced of that.
That is true.
Yeah, there's no way you could have drugs being sold on the same corner or in the same location day after day, week after week, month after month. The police don't know about it. The drug users can find it, but the police can't. So I don't see any point. Matter of fact, it can be dangerous to call yourself telling the police. It can be dangerous. Because I had a friend one time that reported some drug activity. And guess what happened to the police? The gangbanger or whoever, the drug dealer who he said something about, came up to him and said, yeah, I heard you've been talking. I know you talked to the police. Now, he only talked to the police. So how did this guy know a day later that he had talked to the police? Knew exactly who it was that had talked to the police. Because the police told him.
Yep.
So what I'm saying is I personally don't think getting law enforcement involved is the solution. I just really don't. I do think that, again, I always talk about the power of non-participation. I think I put it in every single book that I wrote, and it's like the end, and I call it, 33, I know it's counter-racist strategies, and I think it's 33 ways of non-participating. I don't try to find it. Yeah, the 33 rules of disengagement, and that is some of the things that Mr. Fuller says: stop showing off, bragging, and talking too much. It deals with sex and relationships, self-respect, self-reliance. And what I'm saying is the biggest thing black people can do, that's the most codified thing, is look at yourself and look at the things that you're doing and supporting, the things that you are supporting, you know, I mean, if we're engaging in sex with white people, you know, we have no business looking at all the black person and seeing what they're doing wrong. If we're supporting entertainment that degrades us and we're supporting it financially, or we're allowing our kids to listen to music calling other black people bitches and hoes, we got a whole lot of work to do. You don't need to look at nobody else. You don't need to look outside and see what other black people are doing. There's a ton of work we need to do inside our house. Like Gus said, charity begins at home, and so does self-correction. If we would take it upon ourselves to focus on our own behavior and to try to influence people around us, not preaching and not putting them down, but just sometimes just letting them see, you know, no, I'm not, I don't watch that because it's degrading the black people. You know, I'm not going to this movie. Because I'm amazed, honestly. And I've said this to women. I said, how can you sit in a movie with black men in it, and it's not a single black woman on that screen? This guy never talks to, dates, marries, or has sex with a single black woman. How can you sit there as a black woman in that audience and not be bothered by that? And they just look at me like the thought never occurred to them. So why are you allowing somebody to take you to a movie and spend money with Hollywood studios that marginalize you to the point of non-existence? That kind of stuff we could stop. There's a whole lot of stuff we could do differently. Going to these nail salons and spending $40 on getting your toes done. You know who does my toes? I do my toes. You know what I do? I rub a pumice stone along my feet. I soak them in some water, and I put some polish on my toes. I'm done. You know? So I'm just saying there's a lot of things we could do with our money that's different. There's things we could do with our behavior that's different. So I think codified just means we got to learn to correct our behavior when we contribute to things that make white supremacy stronger. That's what I call codification. I don't call that codification, but I'm just saying. Codified response to the situation described is don't patronize that store.
You talked about that one a lot over the years with Pam with regards to economics. We could do a lot just by being miserly with our spending since so many businesses, a part of the business model is anti-black white supremacy. So, you know, hey, that should do a lot to keep some of our money saved because we're going to have a reduced number of options in terms of where we would be doing a lot of our shopping anyway. I know Dr. Kanban talks about that all the time with just that right there. My counter-racist activity will be to make sure that I'm not financing white dominators and their oppression of black people. He says that pretty much every time he's been on this program. The person that called in, let's see, last, is this retired firefighter? Are you with us, retired firefighter? Do you have a question?
Oh, greetings. Greetings to everybody. Good to hear from you again, Miss Pam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm still learning, like Mr. Fuller says. First I wanted to just commend the lady who is in the tragic arrangement and the decisions that she's made to have a logical understanding of the tragic relationship. I thought that was fantastic. Miss Pam, with the advent of Chicago tearing down some of the largest housing projects in the world, do you think that may have also contributed to the elevation of violence with non-white black people in the city of Chicago?
Well, you know, that's a good question. One thing I remember Mr. Fuller talked about was how black people keep getting moved so we don't form stable communities. We don't have the ability to have second generational homes where we can pass along that. So part of it is just keeping us moving, keeping our communities unstable. A lot of it's economic. White people want those areas back. When they built those high-rises, they built them close to downtown for whatever reason. I have no idea why. But now they want those people gone. Matter of fact, they're supposed to be building an Obama library, I think, And I tell people, listen, if they're going to do that, they're not doing it because they love Obama. I don't know where you get it in your head that they have so much respect for Obama, they want to dedicate a library to Obama. It's basically a land grab out there on the south side near the lakefront, right in that area, Jackson Park, I think it's Jackson Park. It's near University of Chicago. It's near Hyde Park. Public transportation is amazing over there. You got multiple bus routes. You have the Rapid Transit, CTA. You've got Lakeshore Drive. You've got the Dan Ryan. You can get downtown from that area in 15 minutes. They want that area back. And then you're just a stone's throw from the lakefront. You can look out some of these high-rises that black people lived in, lower income. You can see the lake from there. They had beautiful views. So they want them gone from that area, you know, and also keep us moving. Does it contribute to the violence? Probably any destabilization coupled with unemployment and a pitiful educational system, I mean, what chance do the people have, you know? Sparsity of jobs, you know, police brutality, terrible images in the media, and a lot of these places, they're food deserts. I never in my life could imagine growing up that one day you would have black neighborhoods with no major grocery store chains. I mean, what is that about? People eat. Poor people eat, too. So guess what their food choices are? Fast food. These small groceries run by Arabs. So basically they're making sure that their health is going to be poor. So, yeah, it's all that's contributed to it. Matter of fact, I had a friend who lives over on the west side in a neighborhood that's really got a lot of problems, a lot of gangs, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of violence. People, young people just totally traumatized. And he said that one day because I talked to him about chemtrails, and chemtrails are basically when they spray chemicals over populations. You know, what they're doing and what's in those chemicals, I don't know. But he said one day, I talked about chemtrails, he said he knows shortly after that he had seen the streaks in the sky, and after that people were acting really agitated and crazy. And I said, well, is it possible they could be spraying chemicals on people that change their moods? Could be. Can they be putting it in their food? I'm pretty certain they are. I think part of the rise in homosexuality has been due to hormones in the food. So I don't know. They're hitting us on so many different levels that's unimaginable. But I would say, yeah, all of that destabilization of any kind contributes to people feeling unstable. So.
Yes. The last time I visited Chicago, I actually visited the some of the housing projects, and it's not like it was the grandest place to be staying, but certainly when those things are torn down and the people don't have any power to control on where they stay at anyway, and now you have to move on somewhere, and you probably it's probably going to cause problems to frictions between young people and from there I can see where that can contribute towards more violence towards each other.
Yeah, we've been hit on so many levels. Our young people in serious need, crisis level need of mental health. Crisis level. I mean, it's amazing to me that they could be traumatized by all this violence, and nobody thinks that they should be traumatized. I mean, white kids, Columbine, one shooting, and these white students were immediately assessed as being PTSD, and some of them still claiming to be PTSD a decade and a half later, or whenever that happened. But yet, our kids see violence all the time. I never was 10 years old and saw nobody ever. I never saw anybody get killed when I was 10 years old. So we got children out there who have witnessed violence all of their life, and yet people think they should be normal. They think they should be peaceful. Our kids are in serious need of mental health counseling, and it's not available. So our children being hit on so many levels. That it's not funny. And then forget the entertainment. Oh my God. I mean, it's just a tragedy. It's just a tragedy. I just feel sometimes it's just overwhelming when you realize the extent of it.
Yes.
Do you have another question? Thank you. Oh, right on. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. The caller. Caller, it's showing up as. Last four digits, 0325. 0325. Do you have a question for Pam?
Oh, good evening, Pam. Good evening, Gus.
Good evening.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have two questions, one for my wife and one for me. Her question, my wife's question is, she's been seeing, we know a lot of quote-unquote interracial tragic arrangements, and mm-hmm. she noticed that within those arrangements with the black male and the white woman, that the black male, he tends to almost act like, he acts very sheepish. Like when you're in public, he will either walk very far in front of her or very far behind her, almost like he doesn't want to be around her and stuff. Like, what do you think that is?
You know, I think black people in a tragic relationship, I don't care what the sex is, the white person is always the most powerful person. They're the ones that actually establish a relationship. I know we think we pick people. I know we think that being a male makes you dominant over the female regardless of race. No, it doesn't. A white female is the most powerful person in that relationship. And I think black males, maybe that's why so many black male, white female marriages fail. They have one of the highest failure rates in the nation, is because perhaps the men start to get to the point where they're like tired of the feeling of being dominated and control, because they are dominating and control. I think for the women, for a white man to marry a black woman, I hope I'm not getting off track, but for a white man to marry a black woman, and from my experience, she has to be white identified to the point where she's no threat to his feeling of white supremacy.
White identified meaning?
White identified meaning that she has already, in other words, she's not going to offer any resistance to his position as white being dominant, as white being superior. That there's something. In other words, her being a woman, he's not going to marry, this is just my experience, he's not going to marry somebody like me, for example, who's going to be talking about white supremacy, who's going to be opposing his dominance or the dominance of his people. The interracial couples I've seen like that have basically been the black female who's already bought into the idea of white supremacy to the extent where the white male is comfortable with her mentality. As far as the black male, I have seen black men. It's funny. I've seen them both ways. I've seen them where they're proud to be with the white woman and show offy, and then I've seen them where they kind of lag behind. And I think that on some level, he's uncomfortable with the image he's presenting to other people, maybe particularly other black people. Hard to say, but I do think sometimes when black people are in tragic relationships, they know instinctively something's not quite right. They don't feel entirely comfortable with it. So what do you think, Gus?
I live in an area where there are a lot of tragic arrangements out here in the Pacific Northwest. In the West Coast in general, there are a lot relative to, I guess I'll put that in context. You mm-hmm. see more of it, like, publicly than you would in mm-hmm. other places. And I've been to Chicago. I grew up on the East Coast. I didn't grow up out here. So in my travels throughout North America, you see more of it here, just out mm-hmm. and about. I've seen where the white person and the non-white person are like holding hands and just the music is playing, the sun is shining. It's like you're watching an advertisement for the White Privilege Conference or something. I've seen that, and then I've seen, you know, the discomfort that the male caller that he was talking with, like the, I guess, distance where the black person is either way in front or behind or something like that. Mm-hmm. I've seen that as well. All of that just gets at, you know, the incorrectness of this, either the overboard public affection or, you know, where it's something awkward, because I've seen that too, where sometimes it's like they don't really know how to to behave if they're in an environment where it's a lot of black people and they're with this white person. Like, I've seen that, like, where they can be distant from other black people with this person. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen the whole gambit. At the end of it, all is incorrectness. These are tragic arrangements. And that, as you stated, the white person is always practicing racism and they are always more powerful. They're always doing the choosing, whether they're distant or not. It is incorrect, and it is a massive act of racism on the white person's part.
All right. Can I ask another question?
Proceed. Hello? Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Pam, you said something about chemtrails. I've noticed that they spray them all over the place, even in populations with lots of white people. And over the last 10 years, my idea is that it's to block out UV rays or somehow to lessen the UV rays because UV rays become intense. I've been watching UV ray index over the last couple of years. What do you think about that? Like, because UV rays are very dangerous to white people, extremely dangerous.
Now, see, I've heard that, too, that, you know, blocking the UV rays. And I know that in a lot of places like Florida, white people have been leaving because the sun is, you know, literally attacking them. So I do think that there is a certain vulnerability they have, and maybe it's getting worse when it comes to the rays of the sun. If that's why they're doing it, I don't really know. I know that aluminum is in it, barium is in it. Does that block the rays? It could be just for that reason. But even if it's for that reason, what effect does it have on people other than blocking the say there's no sinister intent behind it. What other effect, though, does it have on people, you know, other than the fact it's blocking UV rays? And what effect does it have on people of color who are not, don't experience UV rays in the same way? So I don't know. I've heard that, too, you know, about the UV rays, but I don't really know. You know, what their real intention is or what the damage is being done to plants, animals, or people.
I just wanted to get in really quick because I've heard that theorized from other... Sorry, I hit my microphone accidentally. I've heard that theorized by other guests about some sort of white exodus from the area of the world known as Florida. We have a number of Florida listeners, some right now, retired firefighter, some of them coming up, princes. We have a number. If we ever end white supremacy and have a cow's justice jamboree, Florida would definitely be high in the running for places to have it because we have a lot of folks who listen to the cows down there. I have not seen any evidence. Like, you all have to show me, like, data. Like, you'd have to go and show me like some boarded up houses or something of white folks leaving the good old Sunshine State, because I have seen no evidence of that at all. Like, we had the Dozier School in Florida, where the black children over decades in Florida were killed and sexually abused and everything, and they're having an archaeological dig to go and get the remains because this went on so long and all that. It was white people leading the team. Like, I just, yeah, you would all would have to show me evidence to, I mean, the sun thing, absolutely, but I mean, it's lots of white people on the continent right now, and I mean, you get big time sun on the continent, lots of UV rays, and I haven't seen any evidence of white people saying, oh, no, nah, we're going to have to give up, you know, hanging out in Johannesburg. We're going to have to go back to the cold climate of Europe.
Well, you know, my out is I rated in the mainstream media, so this mainstream media is often reporting fake news. Maybe that was fake, too.
I just happened to
read it one time in some article. I don't know.
It says specifically that, like, white people were leaving Florida?
You know what? I'm not even sure it was mainstream media. I know I read it on the Internet. What news source it was, I'm not sure. It wasn't a black website. Or allegedly black website. It was something about, I bet if I do a Google, maybe I'll be able to pull it up. But it was something about people were leaving because of the sun, the increased number of skin cancers because of the sun, something like that. So I'll see if I can pull it up, you know, because I read it online years ago.
I did see that in Australia, that they're having problems with kids starting to think that they maybe have to make it a law for kids to have sunglasses, because the sun also affects the eyes.
Okay. Well, wait a minute. We have deviated. Now we're on a whole different continent on the other side of the world. We were talking about Florida specifically. That is one thing that's very important in conversations about racism, because that was the question that I raised, was about white people leaving Florida. And the question that I was going to say is, if we have any Florida listeners, or if we have folks, you know, you do your research, if you can show data in terms of, you know, this was the population of white people in Florida in 1990 or 2000, according to the census or whatever other source, and this is what it is 2015, to show net reduction in white Florida residents, that would be something to consider. But I haven't seen that yet, so if someone has that, that would be grand. Coming right up, one of our listeners in Florida.
Can I be heard?
Hang on, retired firefighter, because we have a plethora of Florida listeners to pick from. Princess, we'll get retired firefighter too. Princess, since you had a question, if you want to ask your question and or submit any data on whether or not you've seen white people leaving Florida, you should be with us. Princess?
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus. Hi, Pam. It's good to hear from you. I was anticipating last week hearing from you, but I know stuff came up, but it's good to hear you again because it's been a while since I've heard from you. But my question, my initial question, I just wanted to say is for me, because a lot of people have known my struggles with coping and dealing with other Black people. Loving and having empathy for Black people can be a challenge for me at times. I will admit that. But my question would be, if we are really trying to be serious about tackling the problem, it just seems like there's a lot of confusion amongst Black people as far as what's white, who's white, and, you know, classification. And I know you mentioned something about Russia earlier, and I had shared on my page an incident with this neo-Nazi from Russia that moved to Cancun and killed some activists or something. I just wanted to know, how do we fight a supposed enemy if we don't know who the enemy is that we're talking about? Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Okay. Yeah, no, I was just saying, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know how we're going to fight something that we don't understand. I think that's why it's important to, you know, educate ourselves about the system, but also to focus on our own behavior. Again, I say over and over again, I think Gus, you even mentioned that Black people are not at war. You know, we don't have any strategies to deal with this system. Not really. The only thing I can think of is our own personal, our focus on ourselves personally, what we are engaged in. I don't think we can really control other Black people or necessarily even get other Black people on board where we're coming from. You know, it's even difficult trying to talk about white supremacy with most Black people. So, I say the focus has to be on self. Because Mr. Fuller even talks about independent. And how he wasn't the leader. He wasn't anybody's leader. He didn't want anybody following him. Because I remember when I initially heard about Mr. Fuller, and I thought, wow, you know. And I had heard about Ed Williamson and Josh Wickett, and they were some of the first people I had seen online talking about racism, white supremacy, based on what Mr. Fuller was teaching. And I remember thinking, yeah, you know, it'd be nice to hook up with these kind of people. And then when I heard Mr. Fuller say, I'm not your leader. I don't want anybody following me. And that's when I had to change my mindset. Well, dang, I'm not joining a group. There's no point in joining a group. You know, there's no, you know, I mean, joining the what kind of group for what purpose? So then I started kind of saying, well, Mr. Fuller's saying you got to be independent. You have to think for yourself. You have to, this is what I took from it, that you have to do things that you think are constructive. You have to do things that you think are codified, not join a group of people who are codified or who claim to be codified. So that's the only answer I can see is people. We have to focus on ourselves first. And I find that a lot of people that come to my blog who talk about counter-racism, when I ask them to look at themselves and I say, well, you know, I hear what you're saying about these people, this people. What are you doing? They get quiet. They get quiet. They don't want to talk about what they're doing or not doing. They, you know, have a tendency to focus outward, not inward. And I think that that's where we have to focus initially.
Okay. Well, I'm mainly, well, thank you for elaborating on that. But I think I was more or less just trying to understand how do we talk about white supremacy when we can't, we don't, it seems like some of us don't even know who and what a white person is.
You want to try that, Gus?
How do we do that?
My thoughts, just if I'm understanding your question correctly, how do we come up with trying to find a resolution, a permanent resolution to the problem of white supremacy, white people, when we have difficulty even identifying the enemy, right? You were saying, like we were talking earlier about, you know, Russia and potential conflict and so quote unquote Hispanics, Latinos.
Some people think that Russians aren't
white
and all these other subgroups, and
right,
like I said, I'm in Florida and white people are very happy muddying around here. They wallow in the sun all day. The only time I hear of white people leaving is if they're snowbirds. They have their summer homes here. There's a lot of old money here. The villages and all throughout South Florida, they're very happy here.
I see a lot of white people when I see, anytime I see Florida shown, whether it's Disney World or if the Dolphins happen to be on television or whatever, Florida State, Florida Gators, I see a lot of white people. But to just get to the substance of your question, that is a part of the problem, and why this system is so difficult to address. Because they do make it difficult. I think we had talked before about having racially ambiguous people on television now, that seemed to be a new popular trend to have those type of characters on TV. And it's probably going to be more of that for exactly that purpose, just to make it difficult to identify, to be able to grasp. Are we talking to someone who's white? Is this person white? Is this person not white? They are extremely good at that. Same thing that you were talking on an international level, which is why one of the first questions when we talk to someone, ascertain that. And also with the terms that we use, this is not in my view, this is not a geographic problem. White, there is no geographic place called white. They just go wherever they're going to go and practice white terrorism against the people that they say are not white. That's not, you know, to a specific region. They just want to dominate the entire universe. So that's one of the things that I suggest is to ascertain that as quickly as possible. Is this person identified, accepted as white? You can ask the person in if you have suspicion, because they do lie, if you think that the person is lying to you, you can observe. You can ask other people questions and just observe, and then you still come to your own conclusion. But the racial classification confusion, that is a major aspect of how this system runs. That is a major problem. That's why, as I stated, you just want to try and do as much as you can to get clear information about is this person white or not white, and then you go from there, if that makes sense.
I don't know.
What problem are you having around, being able to identify people's racial classifications, like some of the Russia or Latinos? I know that's one that you talked about before, being in Florida. What
problem are you having around this?
I mean, personally, it's not me, because I get it, but I'm just trying to figure out why don't other black people get that and see that, and we study history enough, and we study white history enough, and even they say it, so...
Oh, because most black people don't do that. Most black people don't do that. That's why, page one, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. And I think most black people, they don't understand that. That's not their framework of how they, you know, begin thinking. Like, they might have bits and pieces of it, but I mean, we just do not understand what it means to be white. Even the importance of racial classifications. I see that demonstrated all the time, where we don't pay attention to that at all, and how serious that is. Like, just wait a minute before we even, you know, get too carried away with an opinion or what have you. Are we talking, is this a white person or a non-white person that we're talking about? And then, you know, we make an assessment after that. That's most of the black people that I'm around. That's not something that they do. They do not value the importance of racial classifications. They don't have a definition for racism. I mean, they just don't. They don't have any of this information. So, I mean, we'd be starting just with basics. What does it mean to be white? What's your definition for racism? And dealing just from basics, in my experience. Did you want to add to that, Pam?
Oh, yeah. I could piggyback on that. I totally agree with you. Most of the black people that I'm around, they don't read. They don't read. So they're not, and they're not really interested in racism and white supremacy. And a lot of the things that they believe about race are what I would consider things that are uninformed. Like, for example, racism is black people practice racism. Black people can be racist, too. I have a conversation with people. Black people can be racist. They don't have that framework. They don't have that framework. And a lot of it comes from the media. The media portrays racial relationships between black and white as something positive. I mean, you look at the movies and the TV shows, and black people are right in there in the mix. On a limited basis, of course, but, you know, there's no accurate portrayals of racism, white supremacy in the media. There's none. And most black people, in my opinion, white people possibly too, get their framework from the television and the movie screen. That's why so many get involved in these tragic relationships, I believe, because the media has made it seem appealing. The media has made it seem like an alternative. They show all these, they show this idealistic world where race doesn't matter. And so that's the framework I see a lot of black people with, is they have no concept whatsoever of racism, white supremacy. And they think of racism, white supremacy, a white supremacist is somebody with a robe, a white robe and a hood on their head.
Mm-hmm.
So the people I know, they don't read. And I'll give you an example. When I'm at work or I go anyplace, I've always have something to read, because I can't just sit there in a waiting room or something like that and just stand there staring into space. And I'm not going to be on the phone. You know, I'm not hypnotized by a phone. So I had people actually come up to me and say, you're a teacher? And I said, well, huh? They said, well, you're reading. I've had people say that to me. They look at me like I'm crazy. When I told this one lady, this older black lady, that, no, I'm not a teacher. You know, I just like to read. You know, I don't like to sit here and stay. She looked at me, and she got up and moved away from me. So it's almost like for some people, you know, I've had a friend of mine, they say, people tell him, you think too much. I've had people say, I don't like thinking. So the framework of a lot of people is not that they don't know anything about history, none whatsoever, because they don't read.
Dr. Welsing did encourage reading is more important than watching television. I have been admonished, really pretty girl I know, sit all the time, says that you think too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All the time. Mm-hmm. The person who dialed in, still learning. Did you have a question for Pam?
Hey, good evening, Gus. Good evening, Pam. Good to hear from you. I just want to add, I spent a significant amount of time in Chicago as a child. And I'm just curious, like, I know we're living in a different age now, but I know back And, you know, I was an adolescent back then, but in the early 90s, I just remember the newspaper would print out on the front page of the newspaper would say, you know, it would say the amount of murders that happened in Chicago. And it was a lot higher in the early 90s. And I'm just wondering, do you think that, and I know, I mean, white people control statistics like that, but do you think the violence is actually higher now compared to, I'm assuming that you were in Chicago back then, but do you think the violence is actually higher, and or why do you think it's being, I guess, broadcasted throughout the media so much? What do you think? I guess if you could speculate, what do you think white folks are up to? And I have
You raise a good point, because the guy I used to date, who was a policeman, he really gets angry when he hears about the violence, because he says it was much worse. He said the violence isn't worse now. He said it was worse over a decade ago. He said, you know, there was more crime, more violence back, you know, like what you were saying. So I think the media, again, it's, you know, it's still too much violence. However, whether it's more or less, it's still too much. But yes, definitely, according to my friend who was a policeman, he says it was much worse. Well, it was worse years ago. But I do think that whatever's in the media, it's all about creating perception. I don't think there's, only thing I really think is free of bias or covert or hidden attempts or hidden agendas is the weather and what time of day it is and the traffic. I think those are the only three things you can trust. They tell you what time it is, they tell you what's happening on the expressways, and they tell you whether it's raining or snowing or sunny. That's the only three things I trust the media to tell me, to be honest with you. So I do think they do have an agenda. And I do think that, again, black people are being portrayed as increasingly as worthless people. We're being trivialized and marginalized. And I think it's worse today than it was 30 years ago. And I definitely think there's an agenda at work. You know, what is the ultimate end goal? Hey, I don't know. I do believe that they're pushing us to breed ourselves out of existence or not breed at all. I do think that they're attacking our numbers in terms of our reproductive abilities, whether they give you a hysterectomy that you shouldn't have had, or whether they encourage homosexuality, or whether they encourage sex with white people and breeding with white people. So they're definitely, we're under attack. I mean, this is a real war. We're not at war with them. They're at war with us. But, yeah, I do think that the crime was allegedly worse then than it is now. But I think that the crime serves, the reporting of crime serves a purpose that maybe it didn't serve 20 years ago. I don't know. But, yeah, they definitely have an agenda.
And, Pam, lastly, it's funny that you did bring up the weather. And a good friend of mine who grew up in Chicago, he speculates, or he has a theory that at some point white people are going to use weather, I guess, similar to, and I think white people, I don't think they have complete control over the weather, but I think they can manipulate it to a certain degree sometimes. But anyway, he has a theory that, you know, they're going to use weather, the cold weather, particularly in the winter. Maybe there'll be a blizzard or something, and they'll use that to, cut the power off, you know, and do some other things, but mainly cut off all the electricity, or allow it to be cut off, and just watch the havoc that'll take place, especially amongst poor black people, because it's, you know, highly populated with that demographic there. And I just want to know, what are your thoughts? Do you think, I mean, white people can do a lot of different things, but what are your thoughts about that, I guess, that theory? And that'll be it for me. Thank you.
I do think that they've done weather manipulation. I think there's absolutely weather manipulation. You know, they're not God, you know, but I do believe anything that they can control, they're working on it. whether it's people, whether it's animals, whether it's microbes, whether it's diseases, whether it's weather, whether it's food. They're working on ways to control and modify everything. So, yes, it would be hard for me to believe they're not trying to control the weather, because they want to control everything. Everything on the planet. You know, the Last Poets was a group that made the earliest rap, one of the earliest rappers, and they talked about the white man got a God complex. Well, I think that's pretty accurate. I think the white supremacists have a God complex. They want to control everything and everybody. And I do believe they're doing weather manipulation. How successful they've been, I don't know. But I believe that they're definitely trying.
We used to play that song when the cows first came on the air, way, 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 way back, 2007. We used to play The White Man's Got a God Complex. That was when there was very little talking and mostly tunes on the cows. But that is another lifetime. So we added Stacy from Europe on the line with us. But before we get to her, we had a few other stateside callers, and then we'll get Stacy, who is hanging tough with us. It is almost 3 a.m. In London, and she is on the line with us live. So the caller in Our Black Mom in Michigan, did you have a question for Pam? You should be with us.
Good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Pam. I'm so excited that I got an opportunity to catch you this week. So I just wanted to say thanks for coming on the call tonight. And my question is, I have your book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, and I plan on sharing this conversation with some people that I've been talking to about your book. But if you can just expound or explain the title a little bit in detail, why you named it that, or how and why is Black Love a Revolutionary Act? And then my second question is, since we're in this system of racism, white supremacy, and white people really don't allow us to have healthy, nurturing, loving relationships, male and female, what can we do to just usher healthier relationships?
Okay. The reason I came with the title, and it's funny, the title just came out of nowhere, because I don't really exactly remember what I was thinking. But I remember thinking that when you look at the attack on black relationships that began since we got on these, since we came on these shores, the idea of black people having healthy relationships, supportive relationships, is a form of revolution. I mean, it's obviously it's a threat to the system if the system is constantly attacking our relationships, attacking the black family, even during slavery, attacking the black family in such a way that we're still dealing with the damage 4 centuries later. So it seemed to me that if you're going to attack something that you see as a threat, then people being able to overcome that attack is a form of a is a revolutionary act. So I just felt that based on the relentless drive to drive black men and women apart, that black men and women coming together, it's something that the system fears. I think I remember reading something, I don't remember what it was, but it was some kind of government, you know, how they declassified a lot of government documents, Freedom of Information Act, and this one document, I can't remember it, and basically it did say it, and you never know what you read is true or not, but it did basically say that after the riots of the 60s, black people could not be allowed to unify. Now, whether that's something that was actually said, I don't know, but I just happened to read this document. And when you think about it, what's the most effective way to neutralize the people? Have them fight each other. It's just like winding up a robot and just watching it walk around until it falls over. So I do believe black people, that's why, you know, I stress in the book, us understanding and having compassion for each other and the damage that was done. And I started the book off with a couple that was a happily married couple. Everything was fine until the woman got raped. And then that marriage broke apart. And then I had, you know, at the end of it, a whole different outcome. But you think about that one example, and this happens in real life all the time. Sexual assault occurs, and the marriage breaks down because neither person can deal with what happened. Now imagine that happening over and over and over and over again to a group of people who are experiencing rape, who are experiencing just, you know, all this kind of trauma, and it happening for hundreds of years. How can we expect to have normal relationships 400 years later? Sometimes we manage, but it's very difficult because we don't understand the damage that was done, and we don't have the empathy that's necessary to understand it. So I definitely think Black Love is a revolutionary act. Otherwise, why would they work so hard to keep us apart? There's power. See, people talk about money and guns and all that. I ain't talking about that kind of revolution. We can't win that kind of revolution. We don't have the means to have, we don't have the firepower or the resources to wage any kind of actual physical combat. But we do have the psychological power. We do have the spiritual power. And we have the power of saying yes or no. The one thing they can't make us do, they can't make us love somebody. One thing they can't make us do, they can't make us marry anybody. Now, maybe that'll happen one day, but right now they can't make us marry anybody, and they can't make us love anybody. We still have a free choice in who we choose to be with and who we choose to love. And that's the power that we have, is over ourselves. So I'm sorry, I forgot your second question.
Well, no, I appreciate your answer to the first one, but the second one was just what can we do to nurture or try to develop healthier male-female relationships when white people in the system just don't really allow us to have that?
That's a very difficult, it's a struggle. It's a struggle because more than likely, if you're at the state of mind that you're at now, meeting somebody who's at that same, who has the same level of thinking or the same, on that same mind, you know, on the same wavelength, is part of the problem. Is I have people email me, you know, on a semi-regular basis about trying to find somebody or being with somebody who is not interested in white supremacy, who doesn't want to hear about it, who has behaviors that are contradictory to having healthy relationships. I think part of this, big part of the problem is finding someone that you can be with who is looking to be more constructive and be more self-respecting. The thing I would say is one piece of advice I could give you is if you know you're dealing with a person who is confused and who is less than constructive, don't have children with them. You know, maybe that's not a relationship you should pursue. We have to be more particular about the people we get involved with. And I know it's natural to want to nest and to want to bond and be with someone, but we sometimes have to make sacrifices. And if you're with someone who is living a destructive lifestyle or who has destructive ways, that's not the person you want to marry or have children with. We have to be more selective about who we have children with. Again, it all goes back to our own behavior. We can't control other people. And I would say having more constructive relationships is being realistic, you know, not being focused on the material things. A lot of us are focused on the material things in our relationships. We come dissatisfied. We want somebody to take us, for women, for example, we want somebody to take us out of wilderness and diners. But what are we doing that's making that relationship equal? What are we doing for that person that we have all these expectations of? You know, and the men, you know, they got their own expectations. But why should you have any expectation of sex if you're not given anything else? So I just think that we have to raise the level of kind of activities we have with other people. And please, please limit the amount of alcohol and partying and bar hopping. You know, we're not really getting to know people in the right circumstances. So I would just say, you know, try to be a good partner rather than trying to make somebody else be a good partner. Try to be one yourself. And, you know, we have to, you know, just, we just have to try to be better mates and partners if we're involved with someone or if we get involved with someone, you know, and be particular about who you get involved with. That's the only advice I could give.
Well, thank you so much, Pam. Again, thank you for coming on this evening and sharing your thoughts. And I look forward to the next time I get an opportunity to talk to you.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for supporting my work. I appreciate that.
Indeed. joining us all the way from London. Stacy, almost 3 a.m. Thursday morning. She might even be with us again tomorrow for Workplace Racism. Did you have a question you wanted to get in for Pam?
I do, Gus, but it's actually
10
to
4. Wow. Woof.
Okay. My sleep patterns are just all over the place. So hi to everyone. I've got two questions. Pam, you said you had 4 books, and I was looking on Amazon, and I could only see 3. So it would just be helpful if you could clarify the titles of your books. And then I've got a second question, which is just around the whole concept of united independence, but also then thinking about what we can collectively do that does deal with some of the things that we all encounter as non-white people, whether that's in the workplace, trying to be, you know, and that impact on home lives, or, you know, how do you do better for your children? How do you support other people? And I'm not talking necessarily about formal organisations, but just, you know, I'm sort of thinking about, you know, well, I was at an event yesterday with lots of black women, and it was really positive. It was a professional event. And just thinking, okay, well, actually, you know, this is a good group of people, but, you know, there are ways in which we all struggle. And whether it's, you know, balancing your mental health so that you can go home and be a good parent to your family, your children and the people that you live with, but also making a difference to community that doesn't mean being part of a formal organisation, but also what does that say about the concept of united independence? And I guess that's a question to both you and Gus. I'll mute my line.
I'll just answer this real quick, Gus, and that is I did do 4 books. The first book was published under A9. The author name was Anon. I called, you know, wanted to be totally anonymous, which I think was a mistake. And the last 3 were published, the author was Umoja. So the first book was Trojan Horse. And if you do a Trojan Horse in Amazon, it should pop up with the author name being Anon.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's where that came from. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I decided to use a better name for the last 3.
Okay.
Did you want to tackle the second question first, Gus, or what do you want
about the United Independent?
Mm-hmm.
I guess my view, if I understand it correctly, in terms of Mr. Fuller's concept of being United Independent and how we go about trying to eliminate white supremacy, where you have people that you care about. Relatives, family members, that sort of thing. I think the previous caller just asked about having healthier relationships between black males and black females, and how you would, that would seem like a contradiction of sorts, if I'm understanding the correct question correctly. Did I understand you correctly, Stacy?
Well, not actually in terms of female-female relationships, but actually taking it beyond households, although your households will be impacted, but it's how we as a community become stronger, avoiding conflict, but also recognising that actually you can't do it on your own, and sometimes you don't have the people in your immediate vicinity that you may be able to talk to, but then actually how do we all individually make sure that we're contributing to improving how non-white people are improving our lot in a very challenging white supremacist environment?
Okay.
And sorry, go on. Yeah.
That I guess just making sure I understand it beyond just the male-female thing in a broader sense. How are we making sure that we are contributing, we individually, and I guess even maybe collectively are all contributing to making sure that black people collectively are solving our problems and adequately addressing racism? And how do you I guess, kind of rectify that or square that with a united, independent framework. So am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it.
I do suffer from my own anti-blackness sometimes. But, you know, so if, for example, I was thinking about, some sort of women's network, for example. But then that means interacting with people.
Well, I think that is a part of counter-racism techniques, is that you learn this material to use it. And in order to solve this problem, eventually, black people are going to have to be able to get some things done together. I don't think we're going to be able to just, you know, go, well, we will just all not talk to each other until we get this. But I don't think that's going to work. So we are going to have to figure out how to improve things to get constructive things done. And I think if you already have in mind, this is a constructive project that needs to be done, that I have an interest in working on. You mentioned a black female project of some sort. Great. I would go about, brainstorming exactly what this group is supposed to do, what, resources would be required. Think of some people that you would like, to see involved in kind of getting this this outfit going, and just go from there. And, since you're one of the people that's going to be a co-founder of this effort, you should be able to have some influence, right, in picking people that you can work with well. And again, this will just be an opportunity. You can think of it also as a chance to practice and refine your counter-racist skills and being able to have contact with other black people and have it be constructive, where it's not conflict. You all are actually doing something that needs doing. I think all of us, I think this program, being able to get on this program and exchange views on racism, I think all of us can attest, a lot of times that can go really bad. It can end up with name calling and cursing. And this is another way you can get on and we can practice, being able to talk to other black people. And we all have our united independent views, right? Projects that we're working on, books, groups that we want to form, films, whatever it is, but we can still come together, in a united, independent manner and help share views on projects. I think I don't think it's a conflict of interest at all. I think you can apply the united, independent method. Several people can come together, work on a project, and apply that same framework in getting something done together as a collective, where you're contributing to greater uplift of black people, and you still have that focus of we're working on this project just as a group of individuals coming together to try to solve a problem. Not this is. This is just a collective of individuals, victims of racism, coming together to work on a specific project. If that makes does that make sense?
Yeah, that was actually really helpful, actually, because and it sounds really logical when you say it, and it's just, it is challenging sometimes being around people, but also really wanting to make sure time is used constructively, and as I said, just avoiding that conflict. So no, that was really helpful.
Did you want to add anything, Pam?
No, I don't think. I think pretty much you said it all. It's something that I don't have. United Independent. I agree. It's just something I think people have to kind of try to figure it out for themselves. What works for you? If you can find like-minded people and you can do constructive things, that's good. So I think it's just an individual thing, really.
And I guess my other quick suggestion would be, in those sort of group collectives, I would say sometimes the most important thing is just keeping in mind what we're here to do. We're not here necessarily to win everyone over to my way of thinking or to get across a certain point. If the goal was to get this bridge built, let's just get the bridge built. I think that can be very, very helpful in minimizing conflict. Like, all this group is about is getting the bridge built. Like, anything else that diverts from getting the bridge built, that is nothing to fuss over, nothing to gripe over. There should just not be a whole lot of time and investment in that. That's just staying very, very focused on what we're here to do and making sure that all of our investment of time and energy and focus is, in a very clear manner leading to this is what we were supposed to be doing in the first place.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of power in individual people on the same wavelength, even if they never meet each other. even to never have a conversation. The fact that people are becoming more constructive and more self-respecting, more black self-respecting, not participating in things that degrade themselves or other black people. I think that's a very powerful in and of itself.
We basically did our 3 hours. I was going to make sure I got in a retired firefighter before we signed out, since he was patient enough to wait. Did you want to respond with your observation on white exodus from Florida?
You have an incredible memory, sir. the answer to the question about white people leaving. You said South Florida, right?
Just Florida in general. They just said Florida. I'm just saying Florida in general.
Well, I don't know where that really comes from. First time I've ever heard about it. I do understand that there's a level of confusion. They're certainly not leaving the fire department, and it don't get harder than that. You know, that's for sure. What I think the issue of confusion is that the white people now has as a primary language Spanish. That's where there's a difference. The relations with the island that is called Cuba goes back to the early 20th century with the Platt Agreement. Ever since, and all of us can point out different times where the numbers have escalated, where tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of white people who call themselves Cubans. I also hear the very confusing term Hispanics, Latins, all of that. You know, it should be quite common to anybody who is attempting to practice counter racism, because it's designed to do just what it gets: confusion. So they are here now. Maybe the white people who primary language is English moved away from them. That's not unusual. White people don't necessarily like each other. Pam can probably articulate on white people who call themselves Italian versus white people who call themselves Irish. You know, that sort of thing. They don't always get along with each other. With me being on the fire department for such a long time, I used to hear the conversation. I would listen in on the conversation of the white people who speak English against the white people who speak Spanish. I made a self experiment to myself over the Ilion situation. I said to myself, okay, I'm going to see if these particular white people are going to be able to succeed in keeping little Ilion at the time. Now Ilion is probably about 30 years old by now. But little Ilion in this part of the world, as opposed to going back to Cuba. And they lost that venue. Now Mr. Gonzalez is back in Cuba, and he's somewhat of a celebrity over there. That has always been all through my lifetime, and I've been here for a lifetime, that they've always had their disagreements. I put it that way, but none of them have disagreements on white supremacy. That's for sure. The main thing down here, last but not least, the last thing down here in South Florida, just to show you the power of the white people who call themselves white Hispanic who speak Spanish. The largest employer has the label Dade County Government on it. Out of that, the largest employer is Dade County Public Schools. Non-white black people make up 20%, about approximately 20% of the population. But yet, out of the resources, financial resources, job opportunities,
work at schools and repairing schools or building schools, non-white black people get less than 2% of those opportunities down here. So with me as a victim of racism and white supremacy, to give you a final analysis, it doesn't make a difference to me on what language the white person speaks, whether it's English, German, Spanish. They are codified in a racist way, and I have made myself very much aware of it. So I would like to say that I'm not as confused as I would figure some others are on that answer. And hopefully I may not have gave the answer, but hopefully I gave some helpful insight on that question.
Appreciate that. Retired firefighter. We basically did our 3 hours. The website again, which is linked in the description, racismws.com. You can get Pam's blog posts, as well as you'll see the links for her written material, Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, The Interracial Con Game, and The Beauty Con Game. You'll see the links at the blog, racismws.com. Any final thoughts you want to leave listeners with, Pam, before we depart?
Just that, just to focus, to turn our radar sights on ourselves and work on being more constructive ourselves, and encouraging other people around you to be instructive, you know, constructive. But I say the main focus is, look inward, not so much outward. And just, work on the person in the mirror to try to be a more constructive person. Will do a lot, I think, towards doing your part in helping to eliminate white supremacy.
Well said. Well said. RacismWS.com. RacismWS.com. Always a pleasure to have Pam on the program. Knew it would be worth the wait. Thanks, listeners, for hanging in, being patient. Knew we were going to make it happen. Hopefully it will not be 6 months before we have Pam with us back with us on the program.
No, I appreciate the patience.
Absolutely.
And understanding. Yeah.
Well worth it. Well worth it.
Thank you.
We will look forward to more of your commentary, written and otherwise, in the coming weeks, rest of the year, Pam. We'll be following the blog as well. And I will again encourage listeners, if you get a book or if you already have a book, write a review. It does not take very long. You can just put down a few sentences, one or two sentences even. You can make it short, but leave a review. It does help. Pam has graciously requested that over the years, and it does make an impact. So leave a review. I've done them myself. Just go to Amazon, quick review. Very helpful. Might encourage some other black people to pick up some constructive counter-racist literature. We'll be back in 24 hours. Workplace racism. Might have Stacey back with us again. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have a problem finding something in the archives, question, guest suggestion, the email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. Sobriety is always best under conditions of white terrorism. Since we are not at war, since racists are waging war against us, we do not want to make their job easier by being intoxicated, cigarettes, alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, whatever other poisons whites come up with, being under the influence of any of that. The evidence shows generally it just makes it way easier for the Darren Holtzclaws and Betty Shelby's and Darren Wilson's of the world to terrorize, rape, and pillage black people. Let's make sure that we stay sober so we can make great decisions, solve the problem of white supremacy as soon as possible. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.